Hello, friends. This is the great Brian Last, and I'm joined by David Bixenspan for this 605 Super Podcast special edition, looking at Houston and the surrounding areas in light of the catastrophic Hurricane Harvey and the flooding and everything else going on. And I thought it was the right time and the right circumstance to put together this special show, looking at some previous segments we've done about Houston wrestling, and of course, talking to my good friend Bix about experiences we've had with hurricanes and what we think about what's going on right now. Bix, how are you?
I'm doing relatively okay. I'm really just hoping that, you know, all of our friends in and around Houston are wherever they can find shelter right now.
It's really nuts because you and me had a very similar experience, obviously, because we're both from Long Beach, New York, a barrier island off Long Island, off the south shore of Long Island, and we were there for Hurricane Sandy. I actually was one of the few people, stupid people, who ignored the mandatory evacuation and stayed when everything went really bad, and I know you had a lot of water damage, and we saw a catastrophe. We saw water destroy a town, flood many houses, destroy so many cars, impact everyone's lives. You know, no electricity, no septic, no water, nothing for weeks, pieces of the boardwalk all over town. It was a disaster. And it's one of those things that I've lived with, and I know you have, and you think about it, and you're like, man, that was crazy. I can't believe I survived it. I can't believe I went through all that. And then you see what's happening right now. And it's nuts to know how much worse this really is than what happened to us, because when it happened to us, it seemed like the worst thing in the world. And this is 10 times worse, at least.
Well, also because not just even from the perspective of it happening to us personally, it was just a unique, weird piece of weather, like that it was so late in the year that it wasn't really in hurricane season. Right now we are in hurricane season, that it was the converging of the multiple storms, you know, just all that stuff on top of everything else. And I mean, not just in Long Beach, that it left. It ended up causing the largest fire in the history of New York City.
That's right. Breezy Point. It burned down blocks and blocks of houses. I don't even know how many.
Yeah. I mean, it took out close to that entire part of Queens, right?
It did. And I mean, that's one of the unique things about this Houston hurricane, in that when it happened to us in the Northeast, it severely impacted coastal New Jersey and coastal Long Island, as well as the south border of Queens. Yet I've talked to people who were in Brooklyn and Williamsburg around that time. I know people who were in Manhattan around that time. They didn't see any of that. I know people who were in mid-New Jersey who didn't see any of that. They didn't see really anything beyond crazy winds. But then you look at what's happening now, and it's not just all these surrounding towns like Galveston and Beaumont and Port Arthur, but it's actually Houston. It's actually a major city that is underwater.
Yeah, and then also even as we record this, it just keeps going and going and going and spreading and moving, and it's moving slowly, so it's still affecting more places with rain still coming down. This is the record rainfall in the history of the United States, which is just mind-boggling.
Again, we experienced this, and it was catastrophe, and it was, for the most part, over in 24 hours. You had to deal with months and months, and at times even years. I mean, the movie theater in Long Beach was closed for a few years after this because there was so much water damage. But it was 24 hours, and then it was clean up and trying to get things back to normal and help people who had been displaced. With Houston, it's still raining, and it's still it's just, like I said, I can't even fathom how crazy it is. I see it on TV, and it blows my mind because of what we experienced, and that's why we're doing this show today, Bix. That's why we're going to look at some classic segments from the Super Podcast about Houston. And we're also going to tell people, please, the only thing we're going to plug today here on the show are charities to help with Harvey relief. And I just want to quickly say a few of them. You know, as we all know, on this show, we do a lot of tiny URLs, and let's do that. First, tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross. I think that speaks for itself. It's the Red Cross. Now, I'm not trying to poison anything, but I do want to say something. I think that's the most widely recognizable place to donate money. But, you know, from my experience, and Bix, I'd like to have you opine on this. You know, the Red Cross doesn't always do as much as a lot of the smaller organizations. And I know there were complaints with them after Was it Katrina? Was it Haiti? I mean, it seems like every major catastrophe, there are issues with the Red Cross. So I'm giving you this first. This is the one President Obama and everyone else who says to help out. This is the first link they say. But once again, tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross is the way you can donate to the Red Cross.
I think the best way to say it, and we were talking about this a little bit, you know, on Facebook and all this, when it gets this big, you do need to donate to the Red Cross. The Red Cross is who is equipped to handle something like this. That's like, I had been kind of waffling, I think the same way you probably were. But once it got to the degree that it is, it was like, OK, yeah, people need to donate to the Red Cross. But in other situations, not always. Now, I was not in Long Beach as much as you were at the time, because your house was miraculously untouched.
Amazing. Yeah.
You were like just in like the sweet spot in terms of elevation and all that. But, you know, so I'm in a, you know, hotel during a lot of this. But from talking to you and other people, it didn't seem like, other than like the one time they came into town for a photo op, that they were ever really there.
No, I didn't see much of a Red Cross presence. But again, I was in a better situation than most. It's miraculous. Like you just said, where I was living at that time was the center of this barrier island. And what really happened, what caused all the damage, wasn't just the winds and it wasn't just the ocean. It was the idea that the bay met the ocean in the middle of town. And
yes,
the town turned into a river. And somehow my house got no flooding. And the last thing I did, I saw when the water came in through the backyard. And then I saw when the water was flowing in the street like a river. And I said, okay, this is it. I got to be prepared. I'm going to have to use my bed as a raft. My records are gone. Everything's gone, but I'm going to have to just survive this. And I closed my front door and locked it and tried to put some towels by the bottom right as the water reached the top step. So I expected it to come in at any moment. And I had my transistor radio. I had some candles. I was ready to blow out in case the water came in the house, and it didn't. I lost my car. Most people did. You're going to hear a lot of people in Houston after they start the cleanup. Everyone's going to lose their car. Every single car is going to be a total loss, because once water gets in that engine, it's done. And it was just, it was complete chaos. And that's why this has impacted me, and I know impacted you, is just because it's so much worse and it's ongoing than what we experienced. But I want to just quickly list a couple other links here that people can use beyond the tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross.
Actually, you know what? I do want to say, just to kind of close the loop on what we said about the Red Cross, though.
Yeah.
I mean, because what you're saying is, you know, sometime, and, you know, to segue into what you're about to talk about, the local groups being better. I mean, the one that I heard the most good things about after Sandy was Robin Hood Foundation. But that's specific to New York. That is a New York charity that serves New York. So, you know, when we're, you know, some of the ones you're going to mention, I'm sure, with the local ones, they're going to do their own things, too. I'm sure that help. And that's just kind of what I wanted to make sure I just got that in before we moved on.
I think that's important to get in. And another couple links I want to give everyone. One is tinyurl.com/GoFundHouston. And what this link does is takes you to a GoFundMe page where there's actually a page of all Harvey related campaigns that are on GoFundMe. So a lot of these end up being local campaigns to feed people, help people, rescue people. So once again, tinyurl.com/GoFundHouston. And one more I want to give everyone, tinyurl.com/GlobalGivingHouston. And Global Giving supports local organizations by helping to meet survivors' immediate needs for food, fuel, clean water, hygiene products, and shelter. And they also assist with long-term recovery efforts. So once again, the three links for the Red Cross, tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross. For a GoFundMe list of GoFundMe accounts that are helping Harvey Relief, tinyurl.com/GoFundHouston. And finally, to help Global Giving, to donate to Global Giving and support local organizations, tinyurl.com/GlobalGivingHouston. And please, if you're listening to the show, if you enjoy the Super Podcast each week, please consider donating what you can to help out people. It can happen to any of us. Natural disasters can happen to any of us. And I know there are a lot of people out there who have been impacted by this. I was speaking to Mike Mills the other day from Booking the Territory, and he told me about his story, his family story about Katrina. So many of us have experienced, whether it's a hurricane or some other natural disaster, it's times like this where we all got to help out, chip in, and do what we can to help our fellow brothers and sisters here on this planet. But Bix, Let's talk a little bit about Houston, because there's such a rich history. And of course, this is just decimated Houston and the surrounding towns, many of which you're going to hear mentioned in the segments that we're going to play here on the show, these small spot shows that they would run in places like Beaumont and Galveston. We'll hear about those. But when you think of Houston, Bix, what's the first thing you think of?
Paul Bosch.
Paul Bosch, those ears, I guess, would be right behind that.
Yeah, those ears. And also then, if you're going to talk about the ears, the great TV commercial and magazine ads he did for, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the jewelry store.
I.W. Marks.
Thank you. Where they show him with like a profile point of view, and he has long women's earrings on, and he says, if I.W. Marks can make these ears look good, imagine what they can do for your wives.
It's a brilliant idea, and I know there was also a magazine ad. You know,
yes.
Glitzy, full of color, full of Paul Bosch's cauliflowered ear.
And even by wrestling standards, he had some interesting cauliflowered ears.
I know, considering also he retired, you know, relatively young, even though he came back and did stuff. He was injured in a car accident, and that's when he started working in the office for Morris Siegel. It's funny, Bix, you bring up advertisers, you bring up I.W. Marks. There is a story related to this storm right now that goes back to those days of Houston wrestling, goes back to the advertisers on Houston wrestling. Tell us what's going on.
Okay, so when I first saw this on Twitter and it got a ton of retweets, I didn't realize who this was because it was listed as Mattress Mac. That's actually the nickname and I guess the Twitter username of so I don't remember if he pronounces it as his last name exactly. It's Jim either McKingvale or Mackingvale. And he's the guy from Gallery Furniture, which was, other than I.W. Marks, always the most prominent Houston wrestling sponsor, maybe even the most prominent Houston wrestling sponsor, because when they did that Paul Bosch tribute special on Houston TV in 95, he was the guy who hosted it.
Right.
Right. So I didn't say what he did. So he
was it 95 or 94 that aired?
I think it was 95, but it might have been 94. Anyway, he tweeted that two of his stores, I don't know if that's all of his stores, were open. The areas to get to them were clear of water. He was offering shelter and food to anyone who showed up. And the thing I love about that is not just that he's offering that and all that, but this is someone who has, honestly, in that scenario, probably the most perfect business to convert into a shelter.
Yeah, that's true.
During that situation, and he did.
He cares about his community. He's a part of the community. He's been on TV for, you know, he was on Houston Wrestling at least in the early 80s, so over 35 years. He's been on TV in Houston doing his commercials. We don't know what other shows he sponsored, and I think that's tremendous that he's doing so much to help people out.
Yeah, and apparently this is not new for him in any way. I mean, he's used it as a shelter during Katrina. He had, you know, people who had to flee New Orleans came in and stayed in the store. One of them, he ended up giving a job to, and the guy still works there, I think doing his PR or something like that. Or excuse me, it was his HR.
It's a big difference.
Yeah, that is a big difference. But I was trying to find in the article as I said that it is a big difference. But still, I mean, that's incredible. And it says several Katrina victims got jobs.
That says a lot about the guy. And we're talking about him. Let's let people actually hear him. Here's a very short clip of him on Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch talking to the wrestling fans about what he's doing over at Gallery Furniture.
Mr. Jim Mack has come to the Coliseum tonight from Gallery Model Homes Furniture to talk to us a little bit about what's happening at Gallery Model Homes Furniture.
Paul, at Gallery Model Homes Furniture over the past several weeks, we've had literally hundreds of the wrestling fans come to see if we did have the lowest prices in town. And they've been amazed. We do have the lowest prices in town. Our customers tell us, and also the fans are telling us, that we have the friendliest people, and they've never met a furniture store with as big an inventory of friendly people, fine furniture, and people that want to make them a good deal on the furniture that they want in their home.
And Jim knows that that's the secret of success, pleasing the fans who go to the trouble of coming out and seeing if he's right. He's right.
That's right, Paul. Our customers do tell us. Every day, the fans tell us we have the lowest prices in town, and we're willing to even bargain on our low everyday prices. So come to Gallery Model Homes Furniture And we will, I guarantee you, save you money.
And he actually pulls out a wad of cash at the end there when he says that, which is pretty cool. You know, seems like a good guy. Seems like a perfect wrestling sponsor, quite frankly. And it's really nice to know that someone with a connection to Houston wrestling is someone who has done so much to help out that community. And it's such, for wrestling history, it's such a rich community, as you'll hear in these segments we're going to play shortly, from Morris Siegel, you know, with Whisker Savage, with Wild Bull Curry and Danny McShane, to when Paul Bosch took over in the late 60s, and you still had Johnny Valentine and Wahoo, and eventually Gino Hernandez, Jose Lothario, the relationship with Dallas, and then the relationship with Southwest, and the relationship with Mid-South, Junkyard Dog and Nick Bockwinkel, so many legends. Almost everyone went through Houston. I mean, it was such a singular town. It was such a unique city for wrestling. It was very much akin to St. Louis. It was like the independent version of St. Louis, in that Bosch brought in anyone he wanted to bring in.
Even if it would get him heat, which it did at times, depending on exactly what he was doing. Like, if he was talking about who's the real world champion while being an NWA affiliate member, or associate member, I should say.
And, you know, you'll hear a little bit of it in the conversation I had with Peter Burkholz a while back on the show when we play that shortly. But no, the other connection, Bix, is Peter was born in, and Paul Bosch, of course, lived in and was the chief of lifeguards in our hometown, Long Beach, New York.
Yes, yes. And for several years, because while he was wrestling in New York, he was, I believe, largely based in Long Beach, right? Because he had, I think he moved when he was a teenager to Long Beach, right? And he graduated from Long Beach High School.
Right. That's actually something I didn't know until I heard it from Peter. Paul Bosch, you know, we always think of him, at least I did, Bix, as someone who moved to Long Beach when he was wrestling in New York. And then he somehow became the lifeguard. I didn't realize he actually grew up in Long Beach. He graduated from the same high school you and I graduated from. And he became a lifeguard. And even when he was wrestling eventually in New York, he was still a lifeguard on the beach.
And that's when and where he introduced Stu and Helen Hart, because Helen was a Long Beach native. Her dad, Harry Smith, was a decorated Olympic athlete that settled in Long Beach. And he introduced Stu to the woman that he would later call his own Rita Hayworth. And the rest was history.
Yeah. So, I mean, Paul Bosch had a history of living in and around coastal towns. And it's an interesting thing that, you know, this disaster now happens in Houston. And of course, the disaster that happened in Long Beach a few years back with Hurricane Sandy. But on this topic, Bix, let's go to our first segment here. And this is from Super Podcast episode 42. This is a conversation I had with Peter Burkholz. Many of you may remember him as the longtime television commentator. He was the nephew of Paul Bosch. And of course, he was also partners with Paul Bosch in the promotion. And this conversation covers everything from the history of Houston in the Morris Siegel days and the Whisker Savage days, till Paul Bosch's retirement at the end of the summer of 1987. It covers all of that. Just one little note I should make about some of these segments. When they were originally recorded, one of the topics we were constantly going to, and it's one people are going to be hearing again on the show pretty soon, was Wild Bull Curry, who was one of the biggest stars in the history of Houston wrestling. So if you wonder, hey, there seems to be a lot of Bull Curry talk here, that's usually how the conversations got going when talking about Houston. But let's now go to this. I was about to say footage. Let's now go to this audio from episode 42, my conversation with Peter Burkholz. A popular topic here on the program recently has been Wild Bull Curry, one of the most recognizable faces in the history of professional wrestling and one of the wildest competitors. And of course, we talked with Bobby Fulton about Wild Bull Curry's time in Ohio. We know he spent time in Michigan, famously spent time in New England. But if you're going to talk about Wild Bull Curry, you have to talk about his run in Houston, Texas. And if we're going to talk Houston, Texas, no one better to speak to than Peter Burkholz, who of course wrote the book When Wrestling Was Wrestling, the wild and exotic inside story of the legendary Houston wrestling promotion. And Peter's on the line right now. Peter, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, Brian.
One of the things your book points out, and I don't think it's something that people really talk about much, but everyone thinks Houston, they think Paul Bosch. You know, they think Morris Siegel, and then they think Paul Bosch. They don't realize it was actually Paul Bosch and the Burkholz family. Your family, Paul's brother, was your father, were involved in every aspect of Houston wrestling from the time you were a boy.
Yes, we were. And of course, Paul was the front man and the star of the TV show. And he was a fantastic promoter. And we were more like the support family. Paul didn't have any children. And of course, in my family, I had three other siblings. And then when we grew up, we were all assigned different jobs at the arena. But it was a family promotion, but Paul Bosch was the promoter and the television announcer. So it was a fun business to be in back in those days, Brian.
Well, on the topic of Wild Bull Curry, you were around Houston Wrestling from the time that you were a small boy. When was the first time you actually saw Wild Bull Curry, and what did you think of him?
Well, as a small boy in later 50s, I was scared to death of him. He was Wild Bull Curry. He actually made his debut into Houston Wrestling on January 23rd of 1953. And I wrote about it in the book. He started the evening being Bull Curry, and then after that Wild debut, he was Wild Bull Curry from then on. And he was a big favorite of Houston Wrestling fans for decades. But when he made his debut, Brian, that was back in the days where you didn't have internet, you didn't have iPods, and you didn't have iPhones and all that. But one thing that we did have at Houston Wrestling is we had a live TV show that was being aired from the City Auditorium in Houston, Texas. And we had a timed period where you actually had to go off the air. It wasn't like in for a while there in the professional wrestling, you can tape matches and then go back and edit them in the studio so that you could fit into the time slot. But we would have to have live television from the City Auditorium. And back in those days, Brian, you had a lot more flexibility, not compared to the WWE these days when they produce their own show. But back in those days, we had Houston police officers who didn't mind every once in a while if you slipped an extra $5 or $10 in their envelope, which back in the 50s was a nice tip, that they'd get involved a little bit. Now, you couldn't hit a Houston police officer, but they had no problem jumping in the ring and wrestling wrestlers down and handcuffing them. And then we had another extra gimmick in the arena, Brian. That back in those days, those arenas, they used to be built where they had what they used to call a holding cell. It was like a jail cell there that at some sporting event or some event, somebody got out of hand or got too drunk, and the local, the policeman handling security would put the person in the holding cell and call headquarters and send down the paddy wagon, and they'd go pick them up. Well, as you can imagine, with that kind of combination, the debut of Wild Bull Curry, he wrestled against Billy Varga, which was a top star in the 50s, and the match just got out of hand, and the police got involved, and they're trying to control him. Can you imagine sitting at home watching this live show, and of course, all this was taking place just as you're going off the air. Wild Bull Curry is battling police, he's battling referees, wrestlers, they're trying to handcuff him. And we go off the air, we're showing that Wild debut, and of course the officers take him to the holding cell, and then, Wild Bull Curry's in that holding cell, and he's shaking the bars, and he's screaming, he went out like a wild cage man, and of course the publicity cameras were going, because back in the 50s, Houston Wrestling was red hot, and we had newspaper reporters there every week, we had, there was only one television show in the early 50s going. But the radio announcers, so it was a great debut. And, of course, Wild Bull Curry was exactly who he was, always inside and outside the ring, Wild Bull Curry. So as a youngster, I was scared to death of him.
Like I said, that face is just so recognizable and so scary when you first see it. No one looks like that. There isn't anyone.
No.
The eyebrows or the face of Wild Bull Curry.
No, he was a character, and he played it to the hilt. He after I started to get to know him and get more involved in the business aspect of the Houston Wrestling promotion and became a promoter myself. In fact, I had the honor in the years that I started promoting on my own promotions that the Wild Bull Curry would come work for me. But most of the time, by that time, he was at the age where he would just come in as a special referee. But, Brian, I'm telling you, especially when we went down to Galveston, Texas, or hit all that surrounding area in Houston, as a promoter, you purposely set up the angle. You purposely set up the situation. And then you'd have your usual referee get on television and say, I'm not getting near that match. I don't want to get hurt. And, of course, on television, you make the announcement, there's only one guy tough enough and wild enough to handle him, and you'd bring in Wild Bull Curry. And he still sold tickets.
Well, that's the thing, too. Wild Bull Curry in the mid to late 70s, in his 60s, really didn't look that radically different than Wild Bull Curry 20 years earlier. It looked like the exact same guy. It looked like he didn't age.
he took good care of himself, and his style lent it to it. You know, when you're that wild and so forth, and picking up chairs and throwing chairs and hitting people over the head with chairs and throwing those fists of his, you're exactly right. When he would come back, even as a special referee, you know, you learn very quickly as a wrestling promoter, you don't bring a special referee unless you get him involved. You know, people come by and they buy tickets to see Wild Bull Curry. Well, you didn't want them to sit in the chairs and just see Wild Bill Curry be a referee. So before the evening was out, you would usually saw someone get hit over the head with a chair or one of his wild stomach punches that Wild Bill Curry had.
One of the unfortunate things, and I've discussed this previously here on the program, is that there isn't more footage of Wild Bill Curry. There are plenty of pictures out there, but actual footage is hard to come across. And we started speaking about him here on the show when NWA Classics, the on-demand site, released a match from 1969, so he's not a young man there either, of Wild Bull Curry versus Johnny Valentine, just these two major presences.
I remember that match. Yes, and in fact, when it was over, Paul and I decided that that was a match that we wanted to save. At the time, Brian, the television tape that we used to broadcast the matches, that next week would used to tape over the matches and use the same tape to save money. And then because back then in the 60s, those 1 hour, 1 inch or 2 inch tapes, whatever the year it was that we were using in the 60s, they were very expensive. But then it got to where they weren't expensive. And I was able to convince my uncle to say, you know what? We need to be holding on to this library because it's worth buying a new tape each week. And I basically really didn't get to convince him to do to save our TV shows, which he and I started buying the tapes in the late 70s when I went to work for Houston Wrestling full-time after I received my MBA from San Jose State University. And I sat down with Paul and I said, this is something that we just need to do to try to preserve some of the history of professional wrestling.
And I'm glad you did. And like I said, I wish there was more. I wish there was video of Wild Bill Curry riding a donkey around the ring in embarrassment. I mean, that's the kind of thing I would pay anything to see. And of course, Houston was known for spectacular gimmicks and stipulations, similar to having to ride a donkey around the ring if you lose the match.
Yes. Well, of course, it started off with the Johnny Valentine or calling Bill Curry a jackass on TV and the vice versa. And that before you know it, Morris Eagles had it worked up that whoever lost had it indeed ride the donkey around the ring. But what was really interesting with Wild Bull Curry is that he was so unique and he produced the kind of action that Houston wrestling fans really loved. And I know elsewhere in the country too, you know, as I found out more about the business and his wrestling elsewhere in the country. He was so wild and unique, it encouraged Houston wrestling promoter Morris Siegel, who, when I started researching to write this book, I had met Morris Siegel as a youngster. So I was aware of him, but it wasn't until I started really researching to give the history of Houston wrestling that I became to really appreciate what a great promoter he was. Brian, he promoted wrestling for over 50 years, and in the same town, week after week. And to have that kind of success, you had to be a great promoter. You had to give wrestling fans what they came to see. And when he saw Wild Bill Curry's unique style and the way he got over with the fans in Houston, we had another real rugged grappler, Irish Danny McShane, who was a big heel in Houston, but the fans respected his toughness. Well, Morris Siegel came up with a great gimmick, and he came up with what he called the Brass Knucks Trophy. And he went out and bought this trophy, made this trophy, and he came up with the Brass Knucks Trophy, and he billed it as the world's toughest wrestler. And Brian, there was times that Houston wrestling fans had more respect for the Brass Knucks champion than when the NWA World's Heavyweight Champion would come to town. They would recognize the NWA champion for his toughness, but also his wrestling abilities. But how can you, they really fell in love with the Brass Knucks champion because he was the world's toughest wrestler. And the rules were no disqualifications. The referee couldn't stop the bout for any reason whatsoever unless the wrestler gave up. It was the wildest matches you ever did see. It also was a great way to mix it up the Brass Knucks Trophy promotions in between World Championship matches and other Texas State Championship matches. So when you run weekly, Mike, you had to really kind of just kind of leapfrogging. I mean, you may have the Brass Knucks Championship Friday night, next Friday night, the World Champions coming in, the next Friday night after that, the Texas Championship match. By that time, you have it all lined up, ready for someone to battle for the Brass Knucks Trophy again. So a great promotional gimmick by Morris Siegel. He had two naturals in Wild Bill Curry and Irish Danny McShane, and it was classic Houston wrestling watching Brass Knucks Championship matches.
Wild Bill Curry comes into Houston, and he's this wild and crazy heel, and eventually the fans take to him, and eventually he becomes wildly popular. The Johnny Valentine match, one of the striking things, is after the third fall, which is a non-finish. The fans rush the ring and pounding on the ring in excitement for Wild Bill Curry.
He was a big favorite. They loved him. And, of course, Johnny Valentine at the time was a big heel, and he seemed to be unstoppable. No one could stop Johnny Valentine. And then the big promotion was that Houston wrestling fans were starting to scream, bring down Wild Bill Curry. So, the promoter, we worked on it for weeks at the programs, on television. Fans were screaming, bring Wild Bill Curry. And the fact that he came down, it was a touching moment, especially when he came in the ring, because he hadn't been there for a few years. But when he stepped in the ring, it was as if he had never left. And the Houston wrestling fans were ready. And, of course, Johnny Valentine was one of the great workers of all time. And so they had a great match.
Of course, Bill Curry has this over 25-year run in Houston, and it begins with Morris Siegel as the promoter and your uncle working with him, and Morris Siegel passes away at the beginning of 1967, so then your uncle is the promoter that Wild Bill Curry's dealing with. What was their relationship like? What was the relationship between Paul Bosch and Wild Bill Curry?
They had a great relationship. They really respected each other, and of course, Bill Curry, when he worked for Morris Siegel, my uncle was involved, even though he wasn't the promoter yet. My uncle was the front man. He was the TV announcer. The first week we had television in Houston in 1949, there was two shows that were on the air that first week. One was the Milton Berle Show, and the second was Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch. And the Houston Wrestling with Paul Bosch stayed on the air every week for 39 years. And that's quite a record, and the continuity there to keep the promotion and television and to keep those kind of ratings week after week to stay on top. And there was most of that time we were the most watched television show during our time slot on Saturday nights. Now, this was before you had internet and cable where you had a choice of 100, 200 channels. There was, you know, three local network channels, and then we branched out into two UHF channels. So Paul and Bill Curry had worked together a long time, not only on the television, but my uncle used to do a radio show. And one of the interesting things that to show you back the old time promotions in the 50s is that Bill Curry battled the Dookie Amuka, who was at the time a very big heel for Houston wrestling fans. And the loser had to wheelbarrow the winner down Main Street of downtown Houston. And Morris Siegel, being the promoter he was, he purposely picked a Saturday morning when, back in those days, Saturdays were huge because people would come into downtown Houston to shop. That's when a lot of families would come in and do their shopping. And they drew 20 to 30,000 people just to watch Dookie Amuka roll the victorious Bill Curry down the middle of Main Street. And, of course, Bill Curry lived it up. He was waving his hands, and the people were going crazy. So, you know, you read about those stories, and in my case, I remember them, and there's something about that era when wrestling was wrestling that somehow people like yourself and I got to do whatever we can to try to preserve that. And the main objective in writing the book was I wanted wrestling fans of the future to read about what it was back in the days of Gorgeous George and Bull Curry and Danny McShane and Luthez and all those. So, but can you imagine that they just make the announcement and the next day that there's 20 to 30,000 people lining up Main Street to see Bull Curry coming down in the wheelbarrow. So they loved him.
That would be on TMZ nowadays. Yeah, that would be the headline on TMZ.
Yeah.
One of the great things about your book is I think it's very easy for someone to think, okay, you know, Peter was Paul Bosch's nephew, and of course, you would later become his partner in Houston wrestling. It'll be about their time, but it isn't. It's about the entire history of Houston wrestling, and that's one of the things I really love about the book. And we've mentioned Morris Siegel. Morris Siegel, for, as you said, 50 years, was the promoter in Houston. And in the book, you do a decade-by-decade breakdown of the early years of Houston wrestling. And, you know, you mentioned Gorgeous George, you mentioned Danny McShane and Bull Curry. There is one character I didn't know anything about, and I found myself fascinated by him in your book. Can you please tell the listeners about Whiskers Savage?
He was quite a character. Of course, he was before my time. I was born in the 50s. His big heyday was during the 30s and the Great Depression. He was a phenomenon. I did talk to my uncle, Paul, who knew him and was familiar with what the run that he had in Texas. He set box office records throughout the state of Texas that was unbelievable back in his Depression days. In the City Auditorium, whenever he was in the main event, he sold out the City Auditorium. Now, we're talking about when people were losing their jobs and people losing their businesses. But somehow, Paul used to tell me how they would bring their piggy bank and then sometimes actually break the piggy bank when they get up to that window and get enough money out of there to see Whisker Savage. I think he's a great sports phenomena at a time when people needed it. His gimmick was he was just a good old American boy, farmer, and that he believed in America and he believed in goodness. And it was a kind of a story that the people who were looking for hope in a time of despair, he just symbolized that. His gimmick was he was so poor that he couldn't even afford a belt to hold up his pants. And so he used a piece of rope. And he was a huge guy, long black hair, long black beard, and biggest smile that you ever saw. And also part of his gimmick was for a while there, he had a pet chicken. And he would put it on a leash. And so that had to be quite a sight, seeing this huge bearded, long-haired man coming down the aisle with a chicken on a leash. And he would get in the ring, and he would take that chicken off the leash, and he'd put that chicken on the top turnbuckle to watch his match. And wrestling fans all thought that the chicken was a well-trained chicken. But in reality, when there's that much noise and so much going on, chickens are going to just freeze where they're at. They're not going to move. But can you imagine also getting in the ring and then the heel tries to stomp on his pet chicken? And before you know it, Whisker Savage is going crazy defending his pet chicken. But what a gimmick that Morris Siegel came up with this Daniel Savage was his name. And it wasn't just Houston. And we're not talking about just one or two times. Week after week after week, he'd sell out and he'd go to Dallas, he'd go to San Antonio. And he really saved the Texas wrestling promotions during the Depression. He was the one that brought the people in when other sports franchises were going under.
And as you said, very unique. You had lots of wrestlers wearing their usual trunks. You didn't have many wrestlers wearing farm clothes in the ring, if anybody. He may have been the first.
Yeah, he may have been one of the first. And then, of course, in the more in the Midwest, when you had the Haystack Calhoun and all the others, they came along. But Whisker Savage, he still holds attendance records in some of the towns in Texas, and as Paul used to tell me, that you really couldn't explain it. He said he just had this magic, this charisma, at a time when people were, back in the Great Depression, we didn't have the welfare system and the support systems that we have now for people who need a little assistance in the economy. These were people that were actually, they were on their own, and it was scary. But every Friday night, of course, they came to watch Whisker Savage, Good versus Evil, which is the universal formula for professional wrestling. And somehow, some way, Whisker Savage, Good won over Evil. And so when they left the arena that night, they left with the fact that you do the right thing, say your prayers, and Good's going to win over Evil.
Your uncle and Morris Siegel have this relationship, and of course, Morris Siegel ends up, as we said before, being the longtime promoter in Houston. And then an incident happens that, in many ways, you could see as being tragic, but ended up changing everyone's lives, from Paul Bosch's to yours to Houston wrestling fans. And that is your uncle Paul Bosch is in a car accident, and that radically changes his future.
It does, because at the time, he was a returning war hero. He was the most decorated professional wrestler in World War II, with two silver stars, two bronze stars, Purple Heart, and so forth. He was just getting into the Texas wrestling circuit. And back in those days, you know, that was one of the big dangers that faced professional wrestlers was the travel. And because you didn't have a lot of these interstates, and you had to travel almost all night to get to the next town. And so they would pile in the cars and they'd pile in their trucks after the matches, and it set out on the road because it worked out so much better for them to wake up in the town that they were working at that night than to get to the arena after a long day's drive. But a truck ran a stop sign, and this is the day before airbags and seatbelts, and it really a severe injury to my uncle, who at the time was married to my Aunt Eleanor, and he did not have a lot of money. He was just now getting back into returning from the war and getting to where he's making some money. And there was no pension. There was no health insurance. So the hospital bills and so forth. And he was really in a tough spot. And I really have a lot of respect for Morris Segal. He recognized that, and he really took a liking to my uncle. And he called him in the office. And Morris Segal was scrambling to try to find some position or something for Paul to do that he could pay him some money so he could feed himself and his wife. And he asked him, have you ever typed out a publicity release? And just according to my uncle, he told Morris Segal, no, sir. And he said, well, try it. He said, here's the card for next week. And my uncle sat down behind a typewriter, and my uncle was a natural writer. I mean, and he came up with a publicity release. Morris Segal liked it and says, you're hired. And the next thing you know, he was the radio announcer for Houston Wrestling. So when television came in 1949, and this was the same across the country, it was just natural for the radio announcer to just be the transition into the television. Of course, it's two different types of broadcast, as you know. But Paul fit in, and he became a really big television star in the 50s, which was a golden era for Houston Wrestling, but also a golden era for national wrestling with Gorgeous George and Luthez and Buddy Rogers headlining these national television broadcasts, and they really becoming the national celebrities and athletes.
Did he enjoy doing commentary?
Paul, yes, he did. He really did. And it's just something that came natural to him. And of course, when you become the promoter, it's a huge advantage to be also the announcer. You don't have to explain to an announcer who you want to put over, who you want to talk about, what angles and so forth. And basically, when we got behind the mic, we knew where we wanted to go with that broadcast and with the wrestlers in the ring. Paul enjoyed it. He liked the limelight, and he was a great promoter. And Barnum and Bailey had nothing on my uncle, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Well, we'll take a step away from Houston Wrestling briefly here. There was something you and I spoke about before we went on the air, and that was that we have something in common, that our families have something in common. And that is, as the listeners of this show know, I am born and raised in Long Beach, New York. And of course, I knew that your uncle was the chief of lifeguards at one point in Long Beach, New York, but I didn't realize that your family actually lived in Long Beach, New York for so many years, and you had such a presence in Long Beach.
Yes, we did. And my father ended up being a police officer in Long Beach. And in his younger days, when he would be the lifeguard, he would then go home and grab his suitcase and wrestling tights, and he would wrestle in various small towns around Long Beach. And, of course, his name was John Burkholz, but he wrestled as John Besh. Up in Long Beach at the time, my uncle's last name was pronounced Besh instead of Bosch. And when he moved down to Texas, he got tired of correcting people, Brian. So he said, you know what, I'm just going to go with it. And he became Paul Bosch. But it's great. I go back in scrapbooks and I see these cards where my uncle was wrestling in the semifinal main event, and my dad was one of the preliminaries or special event wrestlers. But there's some other great wrestling connections on Long Beach. For instance, what was really attractive at that time was wrestlers, professional wrestlers who would wrestle New York City or surrounding the area. They loved going to the beaches in Long Beach, and they would work out, and they would, of course, lay out in the sun, because back then getting the tans was considered healthy and also helped the wrestlers in their appearance in the ring. The lifeguard stand, actually, they would have free weights all around it. And my uncle, my dad, the lifeguards would work out, but all these professional wrestlers who would come there would work out. And word spread about that. So for guys there by the boardwalk, and I'm sure you remember the old lifeguard stand, I think it was there for many, many decades until I think one of the recent hurricanes finally
Hurricane Sandy
blew it away.
Yeah.
But the women, the young girls and the teenagers and the young women, they would set up their blankets all around the lifeguard stand. I mean, the lifeguard headquarters. And they would watch all these men, the lifeguards and wrestlers working out with weights. Well, with the lifeguards out there and the professional wrestlers looking out, seeing all these women watching them, well, you can imagine that encouraged them to lift more weight and get in shape. So there was a synergy there, a synergy that paid off with my mother meeting my father and getting married and starting a family. But Lord Jan Bleers was a professional wrestler who came and worked out at the headquarters there. And my uncle introduced him to Jan Bleers, his wife. And so that was one romantic get-together on the Long Beach sand by the lifeguard headquarters. But the one that my uncle was the proudest of is Stu Hart. He introduced Stu Hart to Helen Hart. I can't remember what her last name was, her maiden name.
Helen Smith.
You're exactly right. Now I remember that. So he introduced Stu Hart to Helen Smith, and they started the Hart family. And Buddy, the Hart family made contributions to professional wrestling and wrestlers and managers and promotions. And my uncle used to always boast that that was his contribution to the world's population, that he introduced Stu Hart to Helen. And I can't remember exactly how many kids they had, but they had a bunch of them.
In the mid-90s, when I was a teenager, I was obsessed with wrestling, but not just current wrestling, classic wrestling, the history of professional wrestling. And I was getting a newsletter that Scott Teal put out called Whatever Happened To? And one of the issues featured Lord James Bleers. It had an interview with him, and it also had his address and his phone number. And he told the story about being in Long Beach and about being with your uncle and being with Stu Hart. And I wrote him a letter. I just said, hi, you know, I'm from Long Beach, New York, and I just wanted to, you know, mention that I'm from here and talk to you a little bit about this. And he wrote me back a letter on Tokyo Hotel stationery saying that, yes, it's true. I met my wife on Long Beach, and I was married on this date at this church in Oceanside. And he remembered exactly where the church was, like what street it was on. And he signed the letter, as he signed off his television show and signed other things, Tally Ho, which is why I end every show here on the Super Podcast with my cry of Tally Ho. It's from that letter I got from Lord James Bleers. Was it hard for your uncle? I mean, here's someone who lived on a beach, who grew up on a beach, was a lifeguard, to be in Houston, to be away from the beach. It's hard for any of us who grow up on a beach to not be near a beach. What was it like for your uncle?
Whenever he had an opportunity, he would go to beaches, especially go back to Long Beach. And of course, he used to always wear sweatshirts he always had, he had the sweatshirt he used to always like to wear that says, I have Long Beach sand in my shoes. It was, as you pointed out, between Lord Bleers and my uncle and my dad and Stu Hart, there was just this magical connection with Long Beach there that the wrestlers really enjoyed. And then Paul would enjoy going to Hawaii. He enjoyed being on the beach. In fact, he told me that the easiest year he ever had in his life was when he was working for the Hawaiian promotion back in the late 30s before they built all the hotels on along Waikiki Beach. He actually lived in a house that was one block off of Waikiki Beach. And Brian, he used to talk about he would work out, he'd go swimming, he'd go spearfishing. And he said, but you know what? He said, Pete, once a week I had to pick up my bag and go wrestle somewhere. And he said that was quite a life, just once a week I had to wrestle and spent the rest of the week on the beach. But you're right, there was a love for the beach, and I find myself with that same love. You know, I spend a lot of my winter months in Pensacola Beach in Florida. I love the beach. And it's really, have you ever been to Pensacola Beach? It's so similar to Long Beach. You take this bridge and you go from the mainland onto the island, and the streets and the stores and the restaurant, Brian, they remind me of Long Beach. And so I'm in Seventh Heaven when I'm in Pensacola Beach. You remember along that main street there that you would have the beach shops and the concession shops and it's a small restaurant. So yes, he loved the beach. Of course, he loved wrestling in Houston too, but you couldn't get Long Beach sand out of my uncle's shoes.
You mentioned your father, John Burkholz, and I said that Houston wrestling was really a family operation. Talk a little bit about your father and what he did for Houston wrestling.
He would play different roles, and sometimes he would be a referee, sometimes he'd be head of security. He was just wherever he was needed. He loved being with the business, but he was really a loyal supporter of my uncle and the promotion. Whatever it took, he was there to help run the business. He didn't wrestle too much when he first came down to Houston because he had received a back injury when he was a Long Beach police officer. So that basically took him out of the ring as a wrestler. But he was a great referee, would be in charge of the box office and in charge of security. Whatever we needed, my dad was there. He was a big help to me when I was doing a lot of what we used to call back in the old days spot shows. These were shows that you went into markets that weren't strong enough to have a consistent promotion. But the way our TV show was so had such high ratings and such a hot TV show, I would, you know, load up the van with my family members and I'd book some wrestlers and I'd go into these small towns. And it gave me some hands-on experience. I had a great experience working under my uncle and being his right-hand man for many years. What a mentor Paul Bosch was. But the idea of going out and doing it on your own just gave me some more experience that I was able to bring back. And just to hopefully make myself a better Houston wrestling promoter. But he would be head of security with that. And, you know, sometimes he would be my referee. And I look back, and, you know, sometimes it would be a hot finish. And my poor dad would be in the middle of it. And I remember a couple times watching my dad literally swing his fist and fight his way back to the dressing room. And I would say to myself, what kind of son would put his father in that position? And one time, I ran up to him in the dressing room and we had a really wild hot finish in Cleveland, Texas, and it was rough getting those wrestlers. And this is before the days where we didn't have the barricades. We didn't have the much better security measures that they have these days. And you're literally sometimes on a hot finish. It was a fist fight back to the dressing room. And I remember one time grabbed some policemen and we went back in to kind of rescue him because he was surrounded and he's fighting away. We get him back to the dressing room and I go up to my dad and I said, Dad, I am so sorry. And my dad got the biggest grin on his face and he said, don't worry about it. It's the business. So I always remember that moment that he gave that big smile.
Houston crowds were notoriously hot. You know, Jim Cornette's told me many times about, you know, having trouble, him and the Midnight Express, getting from the ring back into the dressing room. It was just chaos. Who would you say had the most problems? Who did the fans hate the most?
We had quite a few, and I miss Jim Cornette. I hope I bump into him or get in touch with him. He was great. I loved doing television interviews with Jim Cornette. You had to be on your toes, Brian. I mean, when you're interviewing Jim Cornette, he'd throw that thing right back at you. He wasn't a typical introduce the wrestler, stand back, and they go into their sales pitch, so to speak. But Jim Cornette kept you on your toes, and I loved interviewing with him. But to go back to answer your questions, you know, Wild Bill Curry in his days and Danny McShane, and we would have to, sometimes when we knew it was going to be a wild match, hire extra police. And I finally got convinced my uncle to do it too, because back in those days, you know, you kayfabed everything. And I finally explained to my uncle, you know, we need to warn these officers when it's going to be a hot finish. And I got in the habit of doing that. And it made a big difference because the policemen knew how to position themselves and they were ready to get them out. But the one that really, El Gran Marcus, his picture's on the front cover of the book. I really enjoyed working with El Gran Marcus. He was a good guy, but he would not follow instructions. And I remember being in the Port Arthur, Texas, and you talk about a redneck market. That was some of the wildest professional wrestling crowds I've ever worked with. And I was promoting Port Arthur, and Gran Marcus and Gino were two very hot heels. And Gran Marcus had a way he could really fire up and irritate Mexican fans, because he would get on television and claim he wasn't Mexican, which of course was an insult to wrestling fans. And there was something about his mannerisms, and he would just turn to the crowd. If he just gave that gesture with his hands, just that little gesture, come on, they came. They would come over, and they came with chairs and so forth. And so I'm in the dressing room with El Gran Marcus, and I go up. I said, Senor, no heat tonight. No heat. And he tells me, no problem, Senor. No problem, boss. No problem. And I kept telling him, I'm serious. No heat in this building. It's too dangerous. No problem. No problem. We get in the ring. Of course, back then, if anything happened in the crowd, the first thing you wanted to do was get in the ring. Because, number one, it's easier to defend yourself if you're up in the ring and they have to come at you. Number two, all the lawsuits back then was, how would a wrestling fan explain that he was in the middle of the wrestling ring and he wants to sue a wrestler because he got beat up? So we're getting him in the ring, and as we're going down the aisle, the fans are, they're raising hell, and I'm whispering to Grandma, just no heat, no heat. He starts getting in the ring, and the referee that night was Nick Kozak. And so I turn around as he's getting in the ring, and all of a sudden, I hear Nick Kozak go, "Oh, damn." And Grandma just gave the gesture, and these people came. They started coming with chairs, and they were taking off their belts with the buckles. And I'm telling you, it was about 20 to 30 of them coming at us. And I had a discussion with Carol Albritton, who was the arena manager at the Port Arthur Civic Center at the time. And he had to hire what they call security officers, not police officers, security officers, unarmed. And it was part of the contract when I signed the lease that I would agree to use them. And I told him, I said, I really want police officers there. And he said, no, we have a contract with a security company. Well, when these people came, Brian, I turned around and the security officers literally were running out of the building. And I'm thinking, oh, my Lord. And I'm swinging away, and Nick Kozak swinging away, and Grand Marcus and Gorgeous Gino, and we're just, as they're coming at us, we're just battling them off. And then all of a sudden, in the corner of my eye, I catch this guy running down with a gun. And I said, okay, this is it. But the guy jumped in front of me with the gun, pointed at the riot, and flashed his badge. He was an off-duty Port Arthur police officer who was up in the stands watching the matches with his son. And I even don't even want to think what could have happened that night if he wasn't there and if he didn't have that gun to quiet down the riot. And I took that individual and I took him straight to the operator, the arena manager, and I said, he is now in charge of my security. Because I asked the guy, I said, do you like wrestling matches? He said, well, he said, I like bringing my son. I said, do you want to be head of my security? And he said, sure. So I tell you, that was one of the scariest moments because you just don't know. You don't know what's going to happen when a riot starts to spread and you don't have any police officers there. So he really was a game changer for us.
Wow. You don't hear about heat like that anymore.
No, I think the wrestlers have gotten smarter about it. And I watched the security measures. And, of course, my later years in wrestling and promoting in the late 80s, we started taking a lot of those measures. But nowadays, I'm sure they take it even to it to the next level. And you really need to with today. It's not only the type of people you're dealing with, it's the lawsuits. These poor wrestlers back in the heyday, they couldn't win for losing. I mean, if someone came at them and they ended up putting that guy in the hospital or whatever, next thing they know, they're being contacted with a lawsuit. And so I think Vince is one of the ones that did the best in enhancing the security. And I really think that's for the safety of the fans and wrestlers. So I tip my hat to him on that.
Yes, unlike Bill Watts, who encouraged his wrestlers to beat up the fans and drag them out and throw them into the Louisiana night. That's a big difference.
No, it was quite an experience in the 80s to be partners with Bill Watts for several years, then to actually be partners with Vince McMahon for a few months before it made more sense for him to buy Paul and I out. That the styles are different, and my favorite Bill Watts story was we had just hooked up with Bill Watts. He just bought into the Houston Wrestling Promotion, and he was, of course, he had his own booking office, Mid-South Wrestling. And the first night, we booked this the Friday night, and that Friday morning, I get a call from Bill Watts, and he's giving me, you know, Ted DiBiase was going to be in our main event. And he says to me, Pete, Ted DiBiase broke his hand in Corpus Christi last night. And I said, oh, Bill, I said, the first night we worked together and we have a main event substitution, which back then, that was not good for a promotion. It really would hurt a promotion and hurt the credibility of the promotion. And Bill Watts just shouted over the phone without hesitating. He says, what the hell do you mean? I said, he broke his hand, not his neck. He will be in the ring. And poor Ted DiBiase had taped up his broken hand and he got in the ring that night. So that was my first inkling that working with Bill Watts was going to be quite a experience.
You bring up how a no-show hurts a card, hurts a promotion. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that. And it kind of touches the relationships that the Houston Wrestling Office had with other booking offices, as well as the National Wrestling Alliance. And I guess the first thing I should ask you about is this famous story that everyone's heard now about Dory Funk Jr. being scheduled to drop the title to Jack Briscoe in Houston. And then there's this injury. I guess everyone now takes the Funks at their word that there was a legitimate accident and an injury. The severity of it is questionable. And then you end up not getting the Briscoe Dory Funk Jr. match. Harley Race wins the title in Kansas City, and then you get Jack Briscoe defeating Harley Race for the NWA Championship with Sam Mushnick in attendance. But that would have been a big moment, having the Dory Funk Jr. Jack Briscoe title change. A moment, by the way, that I don't think Jack Briscoe ever got over not having that title change from Dory Funk Jr. But at the time, what was your uncle thinking? Was he upset? And did he believe Dory Funk Jr. and actually Dory Funk Sr. was the one, I guess, telling everyone that his son was too injured to wrestle. Did he believe that was the case?
Well, it's hard to say, because I remember at the time there was this thing that the Funks did have a tremendous amount of credibility with promoters and so forth. So the inkling was, you know, they wouldn't lie to us about this. But then also in the back of our mind, we felt, well, maybe there's some political undertones here. As you know, in the business, there are sometimes that certain wrestlers don't want to put over other wrestlers, or there's other political factors and verticals involved. So there is a mixture of emotions here. First, you're right, we were disappointed, because having a world title change in your town was huge back then. And we were looking forward to it with the Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. And then when the injury came up, I think the only thing that really kind of made it more digestible, Brian, is the assurance was there was going to be a title change in Houston. Okay. So it wasn't one of these things like the world title change that you thought was going to take place. It's just not ever going to take place. It was going to take place. And so to play the political chess game, you swallowed hard and went with it. And with the understanding that the NWA was going to have a title change in your town. And then, as you know, it turned out as being that Jack Briscoe over Harley Race, and then which was great, a great match, and had a lot of respect for Jack Briscoe. What a talent he was, and when he came there to Houston and started getting over as a big star, very businesslike, very cordial, and getting along, and we enjoyed working with him and having him work for us. But the initial disappointment, as you pointed out, was, it would have been a lot nice to have Briscoe over Dory Funk Jr., but for some reason, and now even to this day, and as I'm talking to you now, I can't say with 100% certainty that it was legit injury completely. I do believe there was an accident. I do believe there was an injury. And as you pointed out, how severe it was, I do not know. But somehow, some way, the political behind the scenes was worked out, and Harley Race came and, like a true gentleman, dropped the belt to Jack Briscoe and Easton.
Well, then a few years later, there's another couple of incidents that happen, which lead to Houston leaving the NWA. And Morris Siegel had been a part of the NWA since the beginning. Houston was an NWA city. And then there are these two no-shows with Harley Race, one where he says that he thought it was an evening show when it was an afternoon show, and the other one where he just doesn't show up. What was going on in the Houston office at the time for both of those incidents? Was it something where you thought someone was behind the scenes trying to screw you guys, or did you just think that these were legitimate no-shows?
Well, we'll take the one that where Harley Race showed up late at the Summit. You know, you're talking the 80s, and you're talking about the winds of change were blowing. As you know, all wrestlers were jumping ship, promoters were jumping ship. For many years, in all my career in wrestling, your word was your bond. I mean, we would talk on the phone, and we would have things like Andre the Giant come up to me and say, Pete, I'll be here at the beginning of January. This could be April or March of the previous year. And he says, I'll be coming through Texas that first week in January. Do you want me? And of course, I say, yes, I want you. And we would just walk over to one of these plain old calendar books that you can buy at a Walmart. And I'd write down Andre the Giant on that Friday, he told me, and he would pull out his book and write down Houston. And that was it. I wouldn't see Andre the Giant for 9, 10, 11 months, and I would get in front of 500,000 viewers and have no problem in announcing ticket sales that Andre the Giant was going to be there. There was a code of honor there. Now, in the 80s, money started getting involved. Wrestlers started, it was almost like, feel like they had to protect themselves, because everybody's trying to position themselves to be grabbed by Vince McMahon and those big contracts. So it was a lot harder to get people to do business because they were afraid that if they did business in Houston, that would lessen their marketing attractiveness to Vince McMahon. But Harley Race, I kind of feel like he legitimately messed up on his booking. It was the first time ever to have a Sunday show in the state of Texas. Paul and I had to get them to change the state law. The state law stated that there could not be professional wrestling matches on Sunday in Texas. One of the reasons we changed it, Brian, was the fact that we had a great Saturday night slot and a great, even better Sunday morning TV slot. And we felt very comfortable that if we had a big match that afternoon, to be able to broadcast on TV that morning, the ticket office is open right now. Come on down and get your tickets. Come on down to the arena. And we were able to use that combination and make a lot of money. But it was not only a Sunday show, it was a 3 o'clock show. And I remember Harley Race frantically running into the dressing room. The matches were over. One good thing, he got there in time, and a lot of the wrestlers saw him jump out of the taxi and start running with his bag. And, but they got to the dressing room, and he was very apologetic. He was very upset. It could have been a work, but I do not think so. And it was just a legitimate, plain old booking mistake. And Blake, if you knew more about the professional wrestling business in the old days and Luthez and all that, the first thing a world champion's supposed to do is call the promoter and tell the promoter, I'm in town. I'm staying at such and such motel or hotel or whatever. I'll see you at the arena tonight. Which always was reassuring to a wrestling promoter to say the world champion's in town. He didn't miss a flight, didn't get bumped off a flight, didn't, you know, his car didn't break down, whatever. But I think that first missing was legit. He quickly sent promos, the NWA quickly sent promos that we put on TV apologizing. But it hurt. It hurt big time. As you can imagine, being a wrestling fan, you came to see the world champion and then you're told the world champion's not there. I mean, and Paul and I had a great credibility with Houston wrestling fans, but it did take a hit. The second one, we pretty well had heard through the grapevine he wasn't coming. And I pretty well got the impression, and Paul felt the same way, that it was not an individual decision. It was not Harley Race saying, I'm not coming. And so we understood the political pressure that was on Harley Race. And so we were more prepared for that one. And that was just part of the game of the business during those years, the turmoil.
Of course, that second no-show would happen after the Houston wrestling office stopped working with the Dallas booking office, which, you know, Fritz Von Erich had been a major player in the NWA, including being the president of the NWA for a time. What led to the end of the relationship with the Dallas booking office, and what did you and your uncle think of working with Fritz Von Erich and Gary Hart as a booker?
Okay, first of all, I like both individuals personally. And I enjoyed very hard and very much worked with Gary Hart. I worked, as you can imagine, more shoulder to shoulder with Gary Hart. Fritz would, at that time, was more just the making appearances at his own promotions around Dallas Fort Worth. But you're right, he was the NWA president. He was one of the mainstays. And then what happened was things were starting to really change, and relationships changed, loyalties changed. It was just a time that the camaraderie in the dressing room changed. The wrestlers weren't there so much to, hey, let's do business together. Let's do this, let's do that, because then next week we'll sell more tickets and we'll both make more money off the percentage of the gate. It got to where everybody was out for themselves. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm not going to put this person over. No, I'm not going to do this. But the Dallas office at that time was having trouble securing good talent. Drawing talent. The kind of talent that would draw money in Houston, Texas. Now, the Von Erich boys, I like them personally. They were great talents, and they drew money in Dallas and Fort Worth. They'd come down to Houston. They would hold their own, but they weren't the superstars that we needed to put in the main events and draw the serious money that we were accustomed to drawing in Houston. And then we kept asking Gary Hart, Booker at the time, who's coming in? Who's coming in? Who's coming? Nobody was coming in. And then they started not returning our phone calls. Then we started hearing rumors that they were going to possibly come into Houston. So the fact that we didn't base our whole promotion around the Von Erich boys, I think they took it as kind of an insult. Paul and I felt like we did not want to be that vulnerable. I mean, can you imagine if all of our superstars were Von Erich boys and they decided that we're not coming to Houston anymore under your banner? And at the time, Southwest Championship Wrestling had some stars that used to be big stars for us in Houston. And Wahoo McDaniels was their booker. And Ivan Putski was a big draw for us. He no longer was the Polish gimmick that he was when he first made serious money for us. And then Tully Blanchard and then Gino Hernandez and all these people, they were available in the Southwest Championship. And we were approached by them. And we've always had a great relationship with Wahoo. And Wahoo displayed to us the same competitiveness, ambition, hardworking individual that made us big, big money in the 70s. And we just felt like we had more confidence in Wahoo as a booker. He had some stars behind him, and he had connections to other stars. And Wahoo was a star himself still. And so we made the decision to move over. Our TV ratings had dropped so much that we temporarily lost one of our time slots. Well, Brian, in wrestling business back then especially, you couldn't afford that. You couldn't afford to start losing the television exposure. You couldn't afford not having the talent. Plus, using Wahoo as a booker, there were some stars that we liked to bring in that did not get along with the Dallas office. But once they realized we weren't with Dallas anymore, they started freelancing and coming in. So it was nothing personal. It was a talent move. And we just felt at the time that we needed to make that change. And it turned out that we did have to make that change, and it worked out well.
It's an interesting time in Texas wrestling because it had always been the Amarillo office doing their own thing in West Texas. And then there was the Dallas booking office, which was supplying talent to Houston, as well as what would become Southwest Championship Wrestling, what would become Joe Blanchard's own territory. Do you know much about what the falling out was between the Dallas office and Joe Blanchard?
Not really. The Dallas office, I think Joe Blanchard kind of felt like they were being dictated to by the booking office. Paul and I kind of related that, too. There came a time where they said, well, this is it. Take it or leave it. This is the list of talent we have. Take it or leave it. And Joe Blanchard and I think with his group, they just decided that they would do better to just go out on their own. And they did. And they made some inroads and they grabbed some good talent. But the Dallas office, I really think what happened during that period, Brian, is that Fritz was kind of stepping back. And he was not as hands-on. The Bronco Lubitsch and Gary Hart, they were hands-on trying to make things work. But Paul and I spotted something that really was a big factor in our decision. Bronco Lubitsch and Gary Hart were even starting to lose confidence in the Dallas booking office. And we kind of sensed that in the booking meetings. And you know, when your booker is not really enthused about what's happening for the booking office and incoming talent, I mean, where do you go from there? I think Gary Hart was one of the best bookers I ever worked with. He was very good, but he was facing a situation where everything was built around the Von Erich boys, and it was hard to bring in any baby faces because, you know, when you said Von Erich boy, you're talking plural. So you weren't talking about, hey, come on down to Dallas territory and we'll make some money. You're a great baby face. The response you would hear is, you've got the Von Erich boys. And then, of course, heels had a hard time coming in because the Von Erich boys were built up as Superman, and these heels would come in, and I think sometimes they felt that they weren't able to have the flexibility to get serious heat. You know, they had to keep putting the Von Erichs over. But looking back at it, it was just a time of change of the 80s.
And then, as you said, for several years, you guys work with Joe Blanchard. You use Wahoo McDaniel as a booker. And then eventually that comes to an end. So let me ask you, explain the relationship with Joe Blanchard. How did it go? What made it end? And what are you and your uncle thinking when all of a sudden the relationship ends? You're working with Bill Watts and Joe Blanchard's coming into Houston. He's running against you guys at the Summit. He's promoting his own world title tournament.
Yes, and of course, one of the things a lot of wrestling fans aren't aware of is that when he came and fell flat on his face and coming in against us in Houston, because we were so well established, the next thing you know, we got hit with an antitrust lawsuit. And that took years. A lot of attorneys made a lot of money off of that. But what happened was we were running into the same problem again with the talent situation. We always had a great ability to sign what I usually refer to freelance talent, the Dusty Rhodes. You know, no matter where Dusty Rhodes was working in the country, his mother lived in Houston. And I periodically, Dusty would call me up and says, "Hey, Pete, I'm coming in to visit my mama. And what dates?" And I said, "Yes, I want you." And so he would come in to visit his mom and, of course, work for us because she was a big star. He'd get a big payday. And we always featured him in a top featured match, which he appreciated. And I used to always put together a certain box of tickets for his mom. And he would always tell me, you know, "Pete, thanks for taking care of my mama." And so we had a great connection with that talent. When in the 80s came along, there was not that same connection. So people, of course, Vince was signing his contract, his wrestlers to contract, and of course, they couldn't just jump on a plane, come down and wrestle for us anymore. They were tied contractually to Vince McMahon. But it was just a changing time. You had to be very careful, and when someone gave you a date, then you just had to make sure that you felt comfortable that they were going to show up that day, that night, and advertise them on television and so forth. But what happened, we were working with Joe Blanchard in Southwest Championship Wrestling, and business was slow. It was a tough time for Eastern Wrestling. And Paul, and as pointed out in the book, Paul was going through a very personal challenge as his wife, my Aunt Eleanor, of 50 years, was passing away with cancer. And the combination that the business was changing, and in fact, he would even tell me one night, "It's not fun anymore." And the personal challenges he was going through with my aunt, we just rallied the troops and I put together a big show. We lost about 4 bookings in a row at the Sam Houston Coliseum, which back in those days, when you used to be a so-called weekly promotion, when you didn't run for 3-4 weeks, it was disastrous. People would get out of the habit of coming. But we now put together a really big show, and we set a box office record that night. And Nick Bockwinkel was our main event, and he always had a liking to Paul and Houston Wrestling. And that night, he spent, you know, after the matches, we set a record, a box office record, and sold out the Coliseum. He was spending the night with my uncle at his house, and he approached Paul the next morning buying the Houston Wrestling promotion, which Paul was now interested in selling because of what all was happening. We had just, his wife had just passed away a couple months earlier. So actually, Nick Bockwinkel started to buy into Houston Wrestling, and Junkyard Dog was in the main event against Nick Bockwinkel. He saw the crowd. He went back to Bill Watts, telling Bill Watts what we had drawn, and we get a phone call from Bill Watts. When Bill Watts called and wanted to be part of the Houston Wrestling promotion, Paul and I decided that, you know, we ought to at least meet with him and talk with him. He had tremendous talent at that time, as you know. I mean, he had Junkyard Dog, he had Hacksaw Doug, and he had all these people who in just a couple of years were going to go up to New York City and make Vince a lot of money. So when Bill Watts wanted to buy in, we felt like we had really solidified our talent supply. Bill Watts, Southwest Championship Wrestling, plus the connections that Paul and I had on our own. And when we worked with Bill Watts, Bill Watts took care of the talent in the ring and in the dressing room. I took care of the promotion. And we started to make some serious money in Houston, show after show.
Just how big a star was the JYD in Houston? And did it hurt the box office when he went to Vince McMahon in August of 1984?
Well, I went over to the Superdome that I'd been reading and hearing about Junkyard Dog drawing big crowds in Louisiana. He had not made an appearance in Houston. And I went over there because one of my friends, Ernie Ladd, was one of the big main eventers in the Superdome. And I was in the dressing room, and JYD came up to me before the match had started and say, "Hey, can you use me in Houston?" And we talked a little bit. And then I sat back and watched the matches. And when I saw the charisma he had and the excitement that he generated in that Superdome crowd, he jumped on that apron and he did that howl. And when you have 30,000 people howling back, I said to myself, I need to talk to Paul. I went back to Paul and I said, "This guy can draw serious money for us." And so Paul and I worked it out for JYD to come over. And he got over Houston Wrestling very quickly. And he was a big star. He helped really pack a superstar is not somebody who just comes in there once in a while and packs the arena. It's the one that consistent over and over again packing the arena. And of course, Bill Watts had the talent. And I tell you this right now, I think he was one of the best creative minds of professional wrestling at the time. And he knew how to utilize that talent, Brian. I sat back there, and I felt like I was a geek show. I was getting a lesson on utilizing talent and putting on a great show. And yes, it did hurt, but Watts was tremendous in developing talent. And then so it did hurt. It was a step backwards, but we regained our footing and moved forward.
As JYD's leaving, you have this other hot act that's working for Bill Watts and is in Houston, and that's the Rock and Roll Express. Same thing, just how big was that? Was this Rock and Roll Express, this rock and roll tag team in the era of MTV? And, you know, they had a relatively short run because by early 85, they go to work for Jim Crockett. Do you think if they had stayed around a little longer, they would have been able to maintain their popularity in Houston?
I think so. The Rock and Roll Express back in those days was very simple. If somebody was interested in coming to the territory, they would send some promo tapes. And, of course, we'd put them on TV, and we had two or three promo tapes that the Rock and Roll Express was coming. It wasn't until I saw their promo tapes that I realized they were not marketing themselves as wrestlers. They were rock and roll stars. I mean, I watched the video and the music and they're going down the aisle. And of course they were dressed up like rock and roll singers and the girls were running and screaming and they just wanted to touch them, you know, just like rock and roll stars. And so I went to Paul and I said, why don't we do something a little bit different? I said, I want to get some music, rock and roll music. Let's use some of the music that they're using on the video. I want to blast that music. And then for the first time since Gorgeous George of the 50s and 60s, we hired to use some spotlights at the top of the Coliseum. So then sure enough, in the first night they're there, we turn off the lights. I give the signal. The spotlights come on. The music's blasting. They come down there, and that crowd's going crazy. And they were great workers, too, especially when you go up against people like Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express. That angle that they had was a natural. I mean, you had four great workers. When you have that, you can get a consistent program to draw serious money for a long time. But we used the spotlights, we used the music, and they got over as rock and roll stars. And then to have heels like Jim Cornette had, it was a golden time for us in the 80s. When we had that kind of talent. And Brian, they were working hard. I mean, these people, well, first of all, when you worked for Bill Watts and he was the booker, you better put some effort in the ring, otherwise he'd be waiting for you at the dressing room. But and we had great workers, and I look back at that, and that was probably the best years of my promotion in the early 80s working with Bill Watts.
Of course, Bill Watts had a record-setting year in 1984 around all this new talent, this younger, fast-paced talent like the Midnight Express, the Rock and Roll Express, Terry Taylor, Buddy Landell, mixed in with established stars like Hacksaw Duggan, Ted DiBiase, Butch Reed. So you had this amazing roster of talent. You had spoken about Gary Hart and Wahoo. What was Bill Dundee like for you as a booker?
Bill Dundee worked hard. And of course, when you say as a booker, he was a booker, but whenever you work under Bill Watts, you're the booker, but you're not really the booker. Bill Watts was the main handler of, but I thought he was a good booker. He took care of business. He crossed the T's, dotted the I's. He made sure that the dressing rooms, worked, and he made sure that the matches worked. And, but he was, with Bill Watts, the more I look back at it, and you're exactly right, the talent that he was developing. And so when you asked earlier about Junkyard Dog leaving, there was a kind of a confidence that we had that even if they leave, it's just Bill Watts reloading. I mean, he will grab another Black Star, and within a very short period, he will have them up drawing a big money in the main event as well. But I remember the talent in that dressing room during those years. I remember the crowds that we were drawing. We were holding our own. While other parts of the country were kind of succumbing to the pressure from Vince McMahon, we were just coasting along. We were holding our own, that's for sure.
Bill Watts is widely considered by just about everybody as a creative genius for professional wrestling, but also as someone rather difficult to work with at times. What led to the end of the relationship between the Houston Wrestling Office and Bill Watts, who had owned a piece of the Houston office with you up until that point, and what led you to working with Vince McMahon?
It, again, was a time where all of a sudden things started to change. Bill Watts, he came in on board with the understanding that Southwest Championship Wrestling was still going to be our booker, the booking office, and they were going to get their booking fee. Everybody knew it wasn't long until during the transition where it was going to make more sense that Mid-South Wrestling would be the booker and get the booking fee. Because it was providing more talent and the creative input, and then Bill Watts being an owner and so forth. So when he took over, he started to, we had a great run. But then Bill Watts started to, I think he was really encouraged by Jim Ross, who is a tremendous survivor. I look at Jim Ross's career and how he had to go from one place to another and survive. They went and they formed the Universal Wrestling Federation, UWF. And it was kind of shoved down Paul and I's throats that we're going to be UWF now. But we kind of understood that the NWA was stumbling. Vince McMahon was making his move. And we felt like maybe we could establish the UWF. Then he came and started changing the arrangement. Once he felt like he had the total control of the talent near the end there, and he was making his move into other markets, he started to change what the structure of the compensation and the revenues was going to do, to where I knew the numbers well enough that when he started making those changes, Paul and I knew that we were being squeezed out money-wise. We would still have a role in the promotion and be a part owners. But, you know, back then, when you start changing the booking office from 10% of the gate to 15, 20% of the gate, and the talent percentage changing, the pie wasn't that big. The pie wasn't big enough to allow these sections to get larger. So we had heard rumors that he was talking to Jim Crockett about hooking up with Jim Crockett. Jim Crockett had already tried to promote against us in Houston, and it was all business. It was nothing personal. So when we were hearing that they were meeting, Paul put some calls in to Bill Watts saying, we need to talk. And for days, Bill Watts never returned a phone call. I still think to this day, if Bill Watts would have returned the phone call, the split may not have taken place. But looking back at it, the split probably needed to take place anyway. At that same time, Brian, we were contacted by Jim Barnett, who was a longtime friend of ours. And, of course, he was VP for the WWF at the time. And he said, are you interested in us talking? And Paul, being an old friend of Jim Barnett, invited him down. And we had lunch at Paul's swimming pool. And Jim Barnett said, all you need to do, Paul, is make that call. That Vince had sent word from Jim Barnett, just make the call. And would hook up with the WWF. Paul got kind of spooked with what was going on, not returned phone calls, so forth. You got to remember, right at that time, they just did that WrestleMania No. 3, Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, 93,000 people. And so Paul just felt like that it was time to make the move. I was in the process of wanting to sell out my portion of the promotion. I was teaching full-time at San Diego State University. And I had a great run in wrestling, and at that time I was ready to go ahead and ease out. But we had a good, few months run with Vince McMahon, and the most important thing that came out of it is Vince and I were able to work together on giving my uncle a farewell show, and that was important because I would have hated to see one day that the Houston Wrestling Office just would have to shut down. And Vince and I worked out a deal on that show, and it was a tremendous show, a tremendous way for Paul Bosch to say, after 55 years, goodbye to wrestling, and thank you very much.
That was an area of the book I found fascinating, and I won't give it away here so people can go read the book and see it, but you talk about how you have this short partnership with Vince McMahon, and rather quickly it was apparent that the relationship wasn't making much sense, and it was going to end. And you quickly put together this idea and this deal for your uncle to have this honorable exit, the way he should, out of wrestling.
And I thank Vince for that. And, you know, when I got the word when I was out in Vegas that Vince McMahon was cutting the ties and basically knew what the result was, we literally would have to shut the doors. And I remember not sleeping at night and getting on. And I just sent word to Vince that please don't do anything until we talk. And on the way flight back to Houston, I jotted down some notes, and I called Vince and I said, just please listen to what I have to say and please listen to the whole pitch before you give an answer. And I explained to him, you know, we really needed to have Paul have his exit. And it was really to the advantage of Vince to have his exit. And we were going to crown Vince the new king wrestling in Texas and take over our TV slot. And it just made more sense to do it that way than having wrestling fans saying, what happened? And WWF was going to have to build their own loyalty. But to this day, and I hope someday personally bump into Vince again and shake his hand and say thank you, because I asked for him to please just give us a great card. And he gave us a tremendous card. And he flew in talent, people like Andre the Giant and so forth, who weren't even working on the card to be part of the festivities and so forth. Vince McMahon, that was a class act by Vince. And he could have very well told me after I made my bid, you know, Pete, it's nothing personal, but it's time for us to part ways. He listened to it. And you got to remember also, Vince McMahon, grandfather, my uncle Paul Bosch used to work for Vince McMahon's grandfather when he got into wrestling, and then he worked for Vince's dad. And I didn't never hear this directly, but I heard indirectly that when Vince was making his move, Brian, nationwide, there are certain areas that he told Vince to please wait until he passed. You know, sort of like Michael Corleone in The Godfather, and one of them was Houston because of the respect that his dad had for Paul and for each other. And so when Vince's dad did pass away, Vince started to make his move into Houston. So if there was some tie back. And one of the things I do respect about Vince is this desire to maintain the history of professional wrestling, whether it's Hall of Fame or library wrestling tapes. I think that's very important. And I think it's important for someone like Vince McMahon. I think what you do is very important. And I try to do whatever I can to the people know that, you know what? It just didn't happen in the 80s with Hulk Hogan and Junkyard Dog. There's a business here that has been around for, I guess, now 100 years and a lot of history to it.
There is one other name I wanted to ask you about. It was a name you mentioned earlier, and that's Gino Hernandez. There's been a lot said throughout the years that Gino was like a son to Paul Bosch. And, of course, he really got his break in Houston from when he was a teenager on. What can you say about Gino Hernandez, his relationship with your uncle, his relationship with you, because you knew him the whole time too, as well as his place in Houston wrestling history?
Gino was a tremendous talent, and I lost a dear friend when I lost Gino. He, of course, his father being Louis Hernandez was a big star in Houston wrestling, so of course Paul knew him when he was just a little boy in the dressing room carrying his dad's bags and so forth. So when Louis Hernandez, who was very liked by my uncle and other people, that when he passed, everybody kind of, especially Jose Lothario, took Gino under his wing. And Gino, actually at age 16, he was going to high school, Brian, and on weekends, Jose was flying him down to Mexico and getting him experience in the wrestling ring. And so when he so-called made his professional wrestling ring debut at age 18 in Houston, because back then the state law said you had to be 18, he actually had already been working for 2 years. So he stepped in, and he was tremendous talent. And I think it's one of those stories where he just got mixed up with the wrong people. I'm not talking about the people in wrestling, but being on television and being a star, he started to hang around a jet set that I don't think was a good influence on him. And at the time, he wasn't working for us in Houston. He had already made his move to go to Dallas, and Gino was not a big fan of Cowboy Bill Watts. So he went with the Von Erichs in Dallas, and it was during that time that, my understanding, he went into kind of a depression and took his life. And I still wish that he would have been working for us at the time, because I kind of felt I would have maybe been able to spot that or maybe been able to help him. I don't know. But he worked hard. And he was a fine young man, and I'm sorry he's turned out to be one of the, you know, tragic stories of professional wrestling.
Being that you guys knew him from when he was a kid, and you know, he came up through the Houston wrestling ranks, what did your uncle feel when he got the call that Gino died? I mean, did it affect him?
Yes, it did, and it affected both of us. We were stunned. I was shocked. I was just, I couldn't believe it. and it just didn't really sink in. And then when Paul and I decided we were going to do a tribute to him at the studio and the classic ringing the bell 10 times, that Paul lost it, and I started to lose it too. The real the finality of it, you know, this wasn't a work. This is real life. And you get involved in the business, and sometimes you lose track of the fact that, you know what, the business is a work. There's a real life out there. And this is when times had crossed over, and it was too late. We couldn't talk to him. We couldn't say, Gino, what's going on? And I remember when he was a young star for us, and we used to double date, I mean, with his wife and my wife. And we did a lot together. And he helped me a lot in my early promoting days on the, as I mentioned before, spot shows, because he always made himself available. We enjoyed working together, and he always gave 110%. I mean, at Galveston, Moody Civic Center one night, he had 103 temperature. He was battling the flu, and he was in my main event, and he was sick, really sick. And he was thrown up in the dressing room, and I said, Gino, you don't have to go out there. And he said, no, I'm not going to hurt you down. And he went out there, had a hell of a match, came back to the dressing room and collapsed. We didn't have to rush him to the hospital, but he just literally gave everything he had in the ring before he came back to the dressing room. So, good guy. I consider him a real friend, and I'm still sorry I lost that friend.
So after the Paul Bosch retirement show, you're out of wrestling, and then you have a brief period where you work for Jim Crockett Jr., and then once again you leave the wrestling business. It's been a long time now. What have you been up to, and do you miss wrestling?
I do miss it. I think I've been to 3 live wrestling matches since 1988 when I promoted my last match in Houston. With Ric Flair working against Lex Luger, and we had a really good crowd, and it was just the right time for me to get out. Since then, I went back to teaching at San Diego State University. When Paul and I sold out to Vince, you know, it was a nice arrangement, but in the 80s, when I was working with Bill Watts and made serious money week after week after week for several years, I knew that I was not going to be in professional wrestling 55 years like my uncle, and I was ready to move on to another career. So I invested. Those investments did well. But when we sold out to Vince in the early 30s, I wasn't ready to retire. Financially, I could. And then I had the opportunity, Brian, to go back and teach at San Diego State University, my alumni, I'm an alumni of. And I got back in the classroom, and I loved teaching. I got there, and before long, I started getting the entrepreneur blood in me again and started buying commercial property in Huntsville, even bought a shopping mall. I don't know what I was doing buying a shopping mall. I don't even like to shop. But I found that promoting a shopping mall was the same as promoting Hulk Hogan and Abdullah the Butcher and all the others. And then the commercial properties have done extremely well. I still have ownership in those. But now I spend most of my years up here in Colorado on the Taylor River. I love it up here. And as I mentioned before, I spend time down at Pensacola Beach because I love the beach. And the wrestling had been very good to me, Brian, very good. And I remember bumping into Ric Flair a few years after I was out of it. And he asked what I was doing. And I told him, I made comments that professional wrestling had been extremely good to me. And Ric Flair shook my hand and he said, me too. And this is one of the reasons for the book. When Wrestling Was Wrestling, and it's available on Amazon.com. It's available in Kindle version. I remember being a promoter when back in those days, it was just universal. You gave back to the community. You had that synergy. Paul and I would be involved in charities. Paul and I would do this and do that. In return, the community would come buy tickets and support our promotion. There was a synergy there. And I wrote this book, number one, to try to preserve the history of the regional family promotions. That era is not ever coming back. And number two, every cent that has been made off this book has gone to charity. And anybody who's listening to this, if they buy the book, the profit, every single penny of profits will go to charity. It's back to the old days of saying, I'm giving back. I'm giving back to the wrestling community. I'm giving back to society. I really, as I've mentioned before, have a lot of respect for individuals like y'all because, I mean, Nick Bockwinkel, who you and I used to talk about it years ago. I mean, where would wrestling have been if it wasn't for the hardcore wrestling fan? We're not talking about the one that comes when the world champion comes in or so forth. We're talking about the person who would go to the shows, the person who stayed in touch with other wrestling fans in the country. Nick Bockwinkel and I just would always admire wrestling fans like that and say, you know what, God bless them, because without them, there wouldn't be the business. There's times I miss the wrestling, but you know, you have a good run, and I guess it's just like a good work in the ring. There's a time that you say it's time to go home. And I felt like getting back and work with Jim Crockett and Dusty Rhodes and the NWA, I loved it. I really had a good time. It didn't last very long because Jim Crockett was going through the winds of change, and Ted Turner's entertainment was buying him out, and I was given instructions that I was going to have to quit teaching at Sam Houston State and move my family to Atlanta. And I just felt like, you know what, it's time. It's time to go home. And love the business. I still do. And that's why I enjoy talking to people like you and doing things and trying to sell the book and raise money for charity. It's fun to be involved in that role.
Well, there we go, Bix. Not just a lot of the background story on the history of Houston wrestling, but the history of Paul Bosch, the man who would become so famous as the commentator and the promoter of Houston wrestling.
Absolutely. And I just remembered that I have some interesting Paul Bosch stuff that most people probably haven't seen. It goes back to several years ago. My cousin was interning at the Long Beach Public Library, and he was looking through their historical materials. Like, they had almost like a locked filing cabinet type thing for some reason. So it's not something you could just browse yourself if you didn't work there without asking, and you wouldn't necessarily know what was in there. And there was a scrapbook that Paul Bosch had sent for Long Beach's 50th anniversary in 1972. And includes mostly photos, some newspaper clippings, good bit of photos of Helen Hart and her sisters. And there's also a letter from Paul Bosch on Houston wrestling stationery at 2022 San Jacinto in Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
So I figured might as well just read a little bit of this, just because it gives the spirit of Paul Bosch, who, another thing that I don't think people talk about with him much anymore, very good writer. Yeah, you know, he was a poet. If you read the stuff he wrote in the programs and stuff, it was all very... Yeah, he was able to put a lot of character in his writing.
Yes, yes.
So I figured just read a couple snippets from this. It's not too long, but I figured no point in reading the whole thing and him explaining why the photos are blurry.
Yes.
All right. So, to the Public Library, Long Beach, New York. Dear librarian, I have followed the course of the celebration of 50 years of citizenship for the city of Long Beach with a great deal of nostalgic interest. There is a little too much distance between us to have joined in the festivities physically. The newspaper report sent to me by members of my family asked repeatedly for pictures and other memorabilia dating back to the, quote, good old days, and I thought perhaps some of these items, which I have saved over the years, might fill a gap in your collection. Now, blah, 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 disclaimers about photos, etc. If the information seems personal and repeats my name too often, forgive me, but that was why I saved them.
That's awesome.
I never thought to share them with anyone. They were saved for purely personal reasons. But if some of the wonderful people with whom I attended school in those days or with whom I served on the beach patrol should receive a pleasant twinge of memory, or if some later day historian finds one missing fact that helps them to understand the pride we experienced in being part of the exciting summers and the long, satisfying winters of the best place a youngster ever had to grow to manhood, then this scrapbook will have served its purpose. I hope your collection grows to the proportion it deserves and will always serve as a reminder to those who follow that there was indeed a place such as you are trying to describe in your celebrations. Sincerely, Paul M. Bosch.
Wow, what a way with words. I mean, it's beautiful.
It really is.
Go pick up a wrestling program today. See what you find. Not the beautiful word stylings of Paul Bosch. Certainly not. But on the topic of Paul Bosch, Bix, I want to go to this next clip from episode 47 of this super podcast. This is rather short, but it's just Tom Burke, wrestling historian, telling us what Paul Bosch told him about the impact of Wild Bull Curry on Houston wrestling. Let's go to this clip right now. Did he talk to you at all about Houston, about his relationship with Paul Bosch? And
Oh, yeah. Bull was an old school guy from wrestling. And
he said to me when he says, you know, when I went down to Houston, business was horrible. I popped it up and, you know, I saved the office. And true to word, Paul Bosch told me the same thing, that when he went in for Morris Siegel, Bosch was working in the office, that when Bull came in, the territory was down. And what turned the territory around and Texas wrestling around was Bull Curry.
People to this day still talk about his feud with Danny McShane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just remarkable stuff, you know. Danny McShane was one of the toughest guys in the ring as well.
Once again, I want to give out these links to help with Harvey Relief. Of course, you can go to tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross to donate to the Red Cross. You can go to tinyurl.com/GoFundHouston for a page that lists all the GoFundMe campaigns to help Houston. And of course, tinyurl.com/GlobalGivingHouston, which helps connect your money with local organizations helping to get survivors food, fuel, clean water, and so much more. So please consider donating some money and helping out. These links will all be in the show description as well. And Bix, let's quickly go to another clip. This is another short one. This is from episode 60, and it is from my conversation with the grappler, Len Denton, who, of course, grew up in Humble, Texas, which is just outside of Houston, and I'm sure an area feeling the impact of this storm. But here's Len just talking about some of his memories of Houston wrestling growing up. Let's take a step back. Let's go back to the beginning now. You grew up outside of Houston, Texas, in Humble, Texas.
Yes, sir.
And talk to me a little bit about Houston wrestling when you first saw it and the guys who were there and, you know, the early feuds that you remember.
I remember Rocky Johnson and the Iron Sheik. I remember the Abdullah used to come through. They would have, Gino, right before I got into wrestling, Gino had started his career there. Gino Hernandez, Super Sock, Jose Lothario was one of the top draws there. Moondog Main, Lonnie Main, they come through. Bull Curry, Danny McShane, all these guys, right? Paul Bosch, the announcer. There's all kinds of stars that came through Houston, you know? And I wasn't a big wrestling fan until my dad got involved with it with a friend of his. You know, I was playing sports in school and all that, but had intentions of going to college, but I got caught up in the wrestling game. But I went there to watch it with them, and he ended up meeting Tiger Conway Sr., you know, and my dad did. My dad did construction. This is how it all started. And then he had a fence business, you know, where he put up fences for people, and he had a bunch of trucks. He needed a big carport built. And so my dad and his friend had agreed to help him build it. So he was helping him build it, and on weekends, I would go over there with him to help, and that's how I met him and his son, Tiger Conway Jr., and then got more involved in talking about wrestling, and Tiger said he would train me, but then he decided, nah, I don't know if I got time. So what I done was I went across town where they had the Lucha Libre wrestling going on, okay? And I went over there, and I trained for a couple weeks with those guys, and they was ready for give me a match. And so I was like, holy cow, I'm not ready for a match. I've been training 2 weeks, right? And so I called Tiger Conway Sr. and told him, back then everything was totally kayfabe, if you know what that means.
Of course.
I mean, like, hush mouth, right?
Yeah.
He got pissed when he heard I was over there with that opposition of Lucha Libre people. He goes, you know what? Meet me at the Coliseum tomorrow morning, Sunday morning. And he tells my dad, I'm going to teach the kid what he don't know about wrestling. So I go meet him in the ring, and he tries to blow me up and does all kinds of shit. But I was in pretty good shape back then. You know, I was getting ready to play ball in college, so I was in pretty good shape. Finally, he got tired of messing with me. He goes, you know what? I don't feel comfortable training this kid, and I'm not going to train him. So he got out of the ring, just left us. And so there, I said, you know what? Hell with this wrestling. I don't want to be a pro wrestler. And then I seen the ad in the, I don't know where we seen the ad, but Joe Mercer had a wrestling school across town, just opening up. I guess it was meant to be. And so I ended up over there, and that's how I got started.
Johnny Valentine, Danny McShane, Wahoo, Mil Máscaras, so many legendary names, so many legendary matches in Houston wrestling history, Bix. Do you have any favorite matches?
I have a few. I was thinking about it. Actually, at least a couple of them involve Ricky Morton, but from his two separate runs. one from the run where he would have been in Houston via Southwest, one from Mid-South. The first one from the Southwest run would be when he got a AWA title shot against Nick Bockwinkel at Sam Houston Coliseum, which is on, I was going to say NWA Classics, but I believe it's now NWA On Demand. And it is pretty much everything you would want Ricky Morton versus Nick Bockwinkel to be, in that Morton had a certain kind of match with Ric Flair, which was also very different from a lot of the other Ric Flair matches in that era. And he, in a way, I think he almost meshes better with Bockwinkel, maybe because Bockwinkel had that certain chemistry with the Tennessee style guys from working with Lawler and the other guys when he would go through Memphis. But it's probably one of the, you know, I'd say it's honestly one of the best matches of the 80s, and it's a match we didn't even know existed on video until, you know, the last year or so. Just incredible, incredible match. The other Morton match I was thinking of, which I think is one you should be pretty familiar with, is him, well, excuse me, it's, I mean, it's the Rock and Roll Express. So him, Robert Gibson, and Jim Duggan against the Midnight Express and Ernie Ladd is a infamous match because it didn't get aired on TV because I guess Watts ordered Bosch not to, because there were a number of things that led to fines, like back rakes without drawing blood, Dr. Death doing a run-in in flip-flops, I believe unauthorized use of a foreign object or a gimmick, which I, what was it, Ernie Ladd using the taped thumb or string or something?
It was the taped thumb.
Yeah. And it's one of the better Ricky Morton, getting heat on Ricky Morton matches I've seen. He's just incredible in that. And Ladd puts in what might be the last great performance of his career. What do you remember about that match?
It's kind of one that I remember seeing various times, but it's become a different thing since I've heard Jimmy Cornette talk so much about it. And again, just the record that they set for fines in one match, where I think they were 8 people overall involved and only 2 of them weren't fined. I think it may have been like Cornette and Robert Gibson, or maybe it was someone else, but 2 people weren't fined, but everyone else got a fine for that match. And then, of course, Watts refused to air it on TV. You know, there are so many matches, so many things I think of. I think of, you know, a lot of it was clips I saw when I was a tape trader. Gino Hernandez in the cage with Jose Lothario. Mm-hmm. All of those Guerrero versus
Fabulous Ones.
Versus Fabulous Ones matches. I had a tape once that had just the entire series of matches, which was pretty much a Houston-only feud.
And I borrowed that tape from you.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool, right? I mean, it was Houston-only. You wouldn't see that anywhere else. And then, you know, the JYD versus Bockwinkel. You and I talked way back on the show about Johnny Valentine versus Bull Curry, which is just so amazing to see because it's in color and it's like color is useful. I mean, look, everything we see now is in color. There isn't a lot of Bull Curry footage in color, but just the way Johnny Valentine's face glistens in the light as the blood is streaming down it and he's selling everything with his eyes and his mouth. And it's an incredible exhibition. It's an incredible display of what Houston wrestling was in the late 60s. That's become my favorite. But, you know, of course, there was the famous DiBiase Duggan 85. Coal Miner's Glove Cage, Tuxedo, Loser Leaves Town match. Was that all the stipulation? No DQ, I guess, also part of that. And then I think of 86, the UWF tournament, Duggan versus Terry Gordy, who at that point, Terry Gordy was top 3 domestic wrestlers easy.
And Duggan also almost dies in that match.
Oh, so much blood from when he got posted. I mean, it's actually brutal.
Yeah. And another one I would mention, it's actually fairly short, but it's a Dusty Rhodes, Mark Lewin, Brass Knucks title match where, you know, just a very, you know, heated brawl. And then the finish is you've never bought into the bionic elbow more, because I think it's Lewin's trying to get back in the ring. Dusty just pushes his head down and just elbows him right in the brainstem. Like, it's just, I was like, okay, yeah, that should be the finish.
I've never heard a commentator say that. I wish I had. Elbow right to the brainstem. Wait, why didn't Monsoon ever use that line?
Did he ever use medulla oblongata?
He definitely used external occipital protuberance. Medulla oblongata, I remember Lou Albano using. Yeah. It's amazing. There was like one anatomy book backstage that they all passed around. And they picked like one part of the anatomy, and that's the part that they mentioned in everything they ever did for the rest of their career.
Yeah. And I wonder if the medulla oblongata was affected by Captain Lou Albano's organic brain disease that made him into a villain.
What?
you don't remember that? Okay. That the reason he turned babyface was that it turned out he had an organic brain disease that got cured?
I don't remember that part of it. No, I do not. I thought he turned babyface because Piper turned on him.
No, but it was... Oh, no. It was that I think after the turn they revealed that he had the organic brain disease, which they cured.
Was this the same doctor that Albano took George Steele to?
Probably. Yeah. Well, actually, no. It would have been... Didn't he have his own doctor's name that he mentioned sometimes? Or am I just confusing that with the Rodney Dangerfield, Dr. Biddy Boombots thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure. And boy, are we getting far away from Houston.
Yes, we are. I'm trying to think, were there any others that stand out? I mean, there are some that I still haven't watched that I need to, like the Terry Funk, Harley Race, NWA title match that goes like 45 minutes.
Yeah, me too. Oh, what about Harley versus Andre?
Oh, Harley versus Andre is tremendous. It's close to the Stan Hansen match from New Japan as for what I would say is the best Andre match I've ever seen. I think you could probably go either way because they're much different. I would say they're maybe just tied. It's incredible. And I'm probably, you know what, for an Andre performance, it's probably the best match we have. Like, because he's still in pretty good shape and can move and just really, really tremendous match. And it's like a 40-minute NWA title match. Goes 2 out of 3 falls, and that's also... From the big show at the Summit that Bosch did in, I guess it's 78, where I think it's divided up because the website is individual matches. I believe pretty much the whole card is on there. And that was one of the bigger shows that he ever did.
And you bring up the Summit. Of course, that actually plays a part in the whole story that's happening
in
Houston right now. First of all, of course, the Summit was this big arena in Houston. Paul Bosch usually ran the Sam Houston Coliseum. There was the Summit, and actually in 83, when Southwest, after their relationship with Paul Bosch had ceased to exist, decided they were going to crown their own world champion, and they were going to run against him in Houston. And that was the night that they crowned Adrian Adonis, their world heavyweight champion. That's where they ran. They ran the Summit, but right now it's known for other things.
Yes, it is Joel Osteen's church.
Right. Is it Lakewood Church? Is that what it is?
Lakewood something church, yes.
Lakewood Ministries, maybe.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there was a big controversy because I guess it was not being opened up for use as a shelter, although now I understand it is, so that's good to hear.
Yes, although he's saying that it got overblown and it was always going to be open, although that doesn't explain why his account blocked people on Twitter when they asked about it.
Oh, well, I didn't know that part of it. There you go. And I must say, if I was going to buy a building and turn it into a church, I may keep the name The Summit. I kind of think that has a majestic, where are you going? I'm going to a church. Where do you go? I go to The Summit. I kind of think that works. But anyway, let's go to this, our last segment this week on this special edition of the 605 Super Podcast. And once again, I do want to mention the links that you can use. You can go to tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross to contribute to the Red Cross. tinyurl.com/GoFundHouston for a list of GoFundMe campaigns helping the victims of Hurricane Harvey. And of course, tinyurl.com/GlobalGivingHouston to look for organizations that are local, that are helping people on the ground now and will be in the future. And here's our last segment. Bix, this is from episode 50 of the Super Podcast. It's my conversation with Dr. Tom Pritchard, who, of course, grew up in Houston and at a very early age got involved in the Houston office and then, of course, broke into wrestling after that. So we get to hear a little bit about his time in and around Houston wrestling, in and around the office, and in and around Paul Bosch. Let's go to this right now from episode 50 of the Super Podcast, Dr. Tom Pritchard. I wanted to talk to you about a few different things here today that have been popular subjects here on the Super Podcast. And as I mentioned to you before, we've had several segments recently about Houston wrestling, whether it was the history of Houston with Peter Burkholz, someone you know very well, or Wild Bull Curry, someone I am advocating be elected to the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame because I think it is a glaring omission that he is not already in there. So I want to talk to you a little bit about both of them. And I guess maybe they go together because by the time you were getting into wrestling and watching Houston wrestling where you grew up, I'm guessing Wild Bull Curry was around.
Well, let me start by saying, you know, I was born and raised, first of all, in El Paso, and I moved to Houston when I was 10. And I've been watching wrestling since I was 4 years old. And in West Texas, it was the Funks, Ricky Romero, Glory Guerrero, the Infernos, the Von Bronners, and names like that. Then we moved to Houston, and when we moved to Houston in 1969, Bull Curry was still coming in as a main eventer, and one of the first matches I saw live was a cage match between Wild Bull Curry and Johnny Valentine. And during the match, it appeared that Bull Curry hurt his thumb, and Valentine worked it over, and at the end of the match, you could just see Bull selling the thumb. It was so great. It was just, he was a unique guy. His look, his appearance, his style, and everything about him was unique, especially for that time and era. But I didn't realize until later how small he really was. He wasn't a big guy. There's a story that goes back a while that Bruiser Brody, Paul Bosch, wanted to book Wild Bull Curry against Bruiser Brody. I think Bull was in his 50s then.
Probably 60s. Brody was, probably actually the 60s by then, yeah.
Might have been 60s, but he was old. And it was evident, and here's Brody coming in just destroying everybody, and I think it was Gary Hart who told him, don't book this match, and what are you going to do? And Paul says, oh, hell, you know, you're the booker, you'll figure something out. Well, Brody didn't want to sell for Bull Curry and pretty much just beat the hell out of him during the match, and Paul was pissed, but, you know, Gary said, I told you not to book it. But Bull Curry was a legend, still a legend, I guess, in Houston and everywhere he went. But during those times, again, he wasn't a big man, and that was during the time when big men were, you know, ruled the sport. And I think it was the fact that he knew how to produce, he knew how to get sell, he knew how to get a reaction out of people because he was believable and he looked the part, man. That unibrow and that wild looking hair, and he never broke character. And that's a big difference with a lot of. Well, we're in a different culture and a different business today, but yeah, Bull Curry was definitely a memorable guy. In the ring, wherever he went.
Definitely a different business. You don't see too many people selling their thumbs anymore.
No, and it's a simple thing.
Yeah.
But it really was. It's a simple thing.
By the time you had seen him in 1969, he was already in his mid-50s.
Oh, you think? Yeah, maybe so, yeah.
Yeah, because he was born in 1913, so, I mean, that's it. And by the time he fought Brody, he was in his 60s, and that match probably should not have been made, of course. But smaller guys were able to have good careers in Houston. I mean, Danny McShane wasn't a big guy either, and that's probably Wild Bull Curry's most famous opponent.
Right. But the thing is, too, if you want to talk about smaller guys real quick, you know, it was a different time. It was a different era. And, you know, Danny wound up being a referee in Houston for many, many, many years. I didn't realize what a big star Danny McShane was until I really started digging into the history of wrestling. I mean, one of the top junior heavyweights in the world, he and Gorgeous George had some classic matches in California. And again, one of Bull Curry's favorite opponents or rivals. And he was also one of the guys later on. I had always heard he was the guy who invented using the blade, but I think he was just one of the guys who popularized it. I don't think he was the first one, but he was one of the guys who was a little more known for blading back then and making it more exciting. So, you know, you had guys like Danny McShane, you had guys like Bull Curry that while they weren't 6'8" or 6'5", whatever, they came out and produced and delivered action in the ring. And that's one thing you can always say about Texas. I'm sure you can say about other territories, but in Texas especially, you had a bunch of good old boys maybe coming in from the oil rigs in Midland, Texas, or hell, from anywhere in Houston, Texas, and just wanting to see a good old fight. And most of the time, I think the people in Texas especially could tell if they were fighting or if they weren't. And that was one of the things that I'd always heard about Texas and growing up. That was a general consensus that, you know, you go in the Texas territory, it's going to be a lot more stiffer, solid, and a little more real than it would be, say, if you went into a place like Memphis or Nashville or Nick Coulis and whoever else was promoting at the time. Maybe Jarrett was promoting. I don't think so. I think there was somebody else, but they did a lot of cartoon stuff, whereas in Texas they did cartoons, but they also did rough and tough. You know, I'm going to hit you in the eye and we're going to get a hard way. Hey, I'm going to break your nose. Do you mind tonight? Hell no. We'll draw a Hell of a House next week type thing. You know what I mean? And that's the kind of guy Bull Curry was, and that's the kind of guy Danny McShane was.
Well, Texas wrestling or or maybe I should say wrestling, had its own style. Right. It was known throughout wrestling. But for you, someone who starts watching at the age of 4 and moves to Houston at the age of 10, by which time Paul Bosch had taken over, Morris Siegel had been dead a couple of years, what were the big differences you saw in the two products between West Texas wrestling, the Funks, and Houston wrestling?
You know, I think, honest to goodness, the biggest difference that I noticed right off the bat, El Paso, we got the tape, a bicycle, and they would film in Amarillo in a TV studio. When we started watching Houston wrestling in Houston, they were filming from the Coliseum on a Friday night, and it would be shown on the Channel 39, which was a UHF station back then, on Saturday night and Sunday morning. El Paso had, I think it was a CBS station, Channel 4, and they would play it from the studio. So we watched that on a black and white TV. And I didn't realize that you could take the cameras to the arenas and, you know, film like that. I mean, I didn't even think about it. But that was the big difference, is from taping and seeing it in a TV studio setting and then going to Houston and watching it in this arena. And it was a Sam Houston Coliseum, and it was just two hard cameras on a platform, but it had a different feel to it. Also had Paul Bosch sometimes coming into the ring after the matches to pitch to a commercial and interviewing the guy or saying something to the fans. So that was different. But then also the names were different. Some of them were the same. Some of them we had seen in El Paso before, like Nick Kozak, but Johnny Valentine was a name I just heard of, but I didn't know anything really that much about him until we moved to Houston. And Wahoo McDaniel, Gary Hart, a guy named Buster Lloyd, who went on to be Rufus R. Jones, Tiger Conway Jr., all these names. And then, you know, I started writing Paul Bosch letters when I got to Houston and saying, asking if he would bring, you know, the Funks in. And Doria just won the belt bet on the world title. And Ricky Romero and some of these other guys, well, I never expected a response, obviously, but he actually took the time to send a postcard back to me saying he'll do his best to try and get these guys in. So he was pretty much hands-on as a promoter, and that was kind of cool to get a response back. And then slowly but surely, you know, we started going to the matches and going down to this real cool office he had at 2022 San Jacinto at the corner of Gray. And we would go there, and then we'd get permanent reservations to go to the matches every Friday night. And that was so very cool because, you know, I'd only been to the matches maybe 3 times in El Paso, and that was at the El Paso County Coliseum. Now we're going to the Sam Houston Coliseum, which is kind of a big place. And we're sitting way up in the general admission seats, man. And, you know, that was it was really cool because these guys were big-time pro wrestlers. So that was the biggest thing to me, that taping from the arena as opposed to a TV studio, man. I thought it was the coolest thing.
What was the atmosphere in the Sam Houston Coliseum like back then?
Ooh, smoky and very tense at times. I mean, there was no rope around the ring. There was no barricades. There was no barriers. It was, you know, just ringside seats. And Paul Bosch sat at ringside. And I saw fights there. You could still smoke in the arena. And you could tell when it was getting pretty heated. And Valentine used to get the people up every week. The great Malenko, Boris Malenko, Dean and Joel's dad, he and Wahoo had some tremendous matches. And Gary Hart, the Spoiler, Ernie Ladd. You know, I got to see all these great talents excite the crowd like nobody else could. And they were big, bad son of a guns, man. Occasionally you see somebody take a poke at him, but Paul would usually have at least 4 to 5 cops walking the guys to the ring and from the ring. And a lot of times those drunk cowboys didn't really care, and they took a poke. Sometimes they got knocked out themselves. But it was a very exciting time, man. It was, I mean, wrestling has been exposed throughout the years, no doubt. There's been people who have come out and said, this is what it is, but it never really stuck because you always had your believers and your not believers and people who just came to have a good time. Well, it didn't matter if you believed or not, because when you had a guy like Wahoo McDaniel in the ring with a guy like Johnny Valentine, and if you know anything about Johnny Valentine, he had some real issues, man, and to go out there and be able to just beat the hell out of each other and get paid well for it was all they wanted to do. it was entertaining, but it was action, and it was you could see the sweat fly, you could see the marks come up on their chest or their back, or even, like I said, sometimes, you know, they'd catch a potato and it'd be a hard way, and you'd see the guy with a black eye the next week. So I think, just going back to the culture, I think, yeah, certainly it was a different culture back then, but it's because there was nothing else. It was the business, and it was just going from town to town. It was the Wild Wild West, and the only time you had to show up was an hour before, you know, ship bell time, and everything else, you know, was on you. You know, you could do what you wanted as long as you were where you needed to be on time.
When Peter Burkholz was on the show, I asked him, who did he think got the most heat throughout his years in Houston? And although it was a few years after what you're talking about, his answer was El Gran Marcus. And I'm curious, I'm going to ask you the same question. Who do you remember getting the most heat? And also, do you have any memories of El Gran Marcus?
I do, as a matter of fact. Real quick, when I first started refereeing, I think it was in either Orange or Beaumont or Port Arthur, I think, one of those towns that Pete was actually promoting. And I just started refereeing some of the matches, not never in Houston, but some of the spot shows. And Marcus, he'd seen me around Houston, I guess, being Paul's assistant, because Pete was now promoting and Pete was in a different position. So I took, I guess, Pete's spot at ringside, and also was working at the office during the summer months. But Marcus started telling me, he couldn't speak very good English, but he started telling me about his check. And I don't know what he was saying, because I wasn't really, again, I just want to referee and be around the business. I don't care about the checks back then. And I think Pete was probably talking about with the Mexican fans, because Marcus could be a real controversial Mexican character. He didn't mind telling the Mexican people what he thought. And I'm sure he said a few things in Spanish. I couldn't tell you what he said now, because I don't know Spanish. Don't care to know Spanish. But I could see Marcus getting heat. But the guy who I think probably got the most heat, again, from my recollection and my just from being a fan, I would have to say between Johnny Valentine and the great Malenko, those two guys knew how to not only get heat but keep it, you know, coming back week by week. Even if Malenko would get his head shaved or Valentine would lose, which he hardly ever did lose, but it was those guys, because they just they believed when they walked in the ring they were who they were because they were who they were. So those are the guys I thought who had sustained heat. Pete could probably see it through the promoter's eyes and through dealing with them a little differently than I did. But from watching it as a fan, I think it would be Valentine and Malenko that garnered the most heat.
Of course, Malenko is one of the great talkers of all time. And I want to ask you, what did you think when you saw Houston wrestling? You know, again, a difference from wrestling in West Texas. And saw these promos being conducted by Paul Bosch with the wrestlers. Who impressed you the most as a talker? And also, at some point, did you become a heel fan?
Wow. You know, here's the thing. I always thought Terry Funk was a great talker, one of the best. But he was always a babyface in El Paso. But when he came to Houston, you know, as I said, Dory just won the belt. I think he won it in February 69, and we moved in July of 69. So, you know, this was during the time when Terry and Dory Sr. were going across the country as the, you know, the official policeman for the world champion. So Terry would come in first, and he'd get beat. And then Dory Sr. would come in first as the king of the Texas death matches. Out of 2,000 Texas death matches, he's never lost one. Well, that's a particular night he faced Jose Lothario. Well, shit, that was his first ever loss in Texas death match. You know what I mean? And Jose'd come in and wrestle Dory. But they would send these heel promos to Houston, and I just thought they were tremendous, and they were. Of course, Malenko was a great talker, and he knew how to get over. He was the one who coined the phrase Mr. TV announcer. Dusty Rhodes, even as a heel, was a great talker. Jose Lothario knew how to connect. But Gino Hernandez also, I have to say this, Gino Hernandez, I saw Gino rise. He started out at the second, just taking jackets back. And, you know, you noticed him. You knew the guy was there. Then you learned about him. Never really talked to him, but, you know, you learned who he was. And Paul might mention, you know, Gino Hernandez as his second to somebody or whatever, the son of Luis Hernandez, who wrestled as a medic. And he'd go into a little history lesson there. But Gino started out as a baby face, but that was as far from what Juno was in life as it ever got. He was not a baby face. He could be a good guy, but the reality was Juno was a natural heel, and he was a natural talker, and he knew, and he just had this chip on his shoulder and never left. So I thought Juno was another great promo guy. Gosh, man, I'm trying to think who else really impressed me. Those are the guys that really stood out in the very beginning.
I believe you would have already been working in the office and working as an assistant to Paul Bosch when Juno really started taking off. And it really was like a youth injection into Houston when Juno was all of a sudden at the top of the cards.
Agree with you 100%.
What was his relationship like with Paul Bosch? You know, it was always said that Paul Bosch really thought of him like a son. Do you think Paul saw him as, you know, an heir apparent to Houston wrestling in terms of being the top guy?
I don't know if Paul saw him as heir apparent necessarily, but I do believe, and look, no doubt about it, Juno was a talented guy. He really, really was. He had the looks. He had charisma. But I believe Paul, and this is what I found out later, because, you know, all I ever wanted to do was wrestle. And when I told Paul that, you know, many, many times before he even let me work at the office, he told me I'd never make it. I'm too small. You don't want to do this. And always trying to talk me out of it. But I have to say, he gave me an opportunity. And once I started wrestling, I mean, I knew I wasn't going to be the main eventer. I never had that aspiration. I just wanted to be in the business. But I think with Juno, Paul saw a guy who had the size. He had the talent. He had the passion. And you have to have passion. You have to have an ego. You have to have this it factor. You have to, I learned this, but it's one of the things that you have to know how to do it or you don't. You either do know how to do it or you don't. To be on top, every top guy has this trait, and it is this drive and this passion and this ego, a healthy ego. And Juno had it. Juno had it all. And I think Paul recognized that. And being from Houston as a young guy, and the people did see him grow up, I think Paul recognized that Juno had all these attributes and everything it took to be a top guy, not just in Houston, but wherever he went. So I don't know that he saw Juno as the future or heir apparent, so to speak. But for that time, it was a youth movement, and you had the Von Erichs in Dallas starting about the same time. And you know the history between Dallas and Houston, I'm sure.
Yeah.
A lot of history there. So I think that was his Von Erich, so to speak, if anything. But, yeah, as far as being the guy, you know, there was always going to be other guys there. But Paul, I think, made sure to put Juno in the spot that he felt he deserved. And I'm sure he also felt a little kinship because his mom or, you know, his stepdad was Luis Hernandez, and he died in Japan. And maybe he felt, I don't know if it's obligated, but maybe he felt, why not give this guy a chance? And he gave him a chance, and he saw that he did draw for him. And my God, Juno did draw. I mean, he really did. You can't argue with that. I can argue with success. But as life went on. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You say how Paul tried to dissuade you from becoming a professional wrestler, which certainly shows how much he cared about you, that he was trying to
tell
you.
No, by all means. I understand what he's saying now, definitely.
I want to know if you could tell the story, because I've heard it before, and I think the listeners would love it, about when you received your first wrestling license.
Oh, yeah. Well, he actually, it was before I got my wrestling license. I was in the office, and I was counting tickets or was doing something, and Paul just came in and put something in front of me. And I looked at it, and I saw on the front, it was his wrestling license, and I turned it around on the back, and it said, "To Tom Pritchard, this is my last wrestling license. Save it along with your first, Paul Bosch." And I did. And I've had that ever since then. So I did save it along with my first. So I thought, you know, by that time, because I had trained, I'd gone down to the Coliseum with the Iron Sheik and this football player. We thought he was going to be a big star. I thought wrestling was all phony and just go in there and flop around and it'll make millions of dollars. Well, you know, I'd done that and I didn't quit because Cosgrove stretched me a couple times. And then I started training with Nick Kozak and Joe Mercer, who had a ring set up in their record service in Houston downtown, or on the other side of town, whichever it was. And I had been training there for a while, and they didn't really stretch me. But, I mean, it wasn't glamorous. It wasn't great. But I loved every minute of it. I mean, the ring was right there on the edge of a pit where you could fell in. You're going to fall on some old, dirty, rotten tools that had been there for, like, I don't know, 12 years or whatever. And it's a matter of either knowing that you want to do this or you just want to do this to be a big TV star or be a big superstar or whatever. And that was never my intention. It was a lifestyle. It was a business. It was belonging to that fraternity and that club of getting in the ring every night and knowing that you're putting on a performance that you know how to, that you're creating, that it's the best improv business in the world, man. We didn't write scripts back then. We didn't map out our matches A, B, C, D, E. That's really what I was looking for, and I tried to convince Paul of that the whole time I was with him. And I think he finally got it. It's like, there's nothing you can say or do to make me not want to do this. The hardships, you can tell me all about. I made some trips, some spot shows. I've seen the big arenas. I've seen these little high schools. I've seen these little, they were called sportatoriums back then, that some of them held 200 people max. But it was just the atmosphere, the whole connection with this bunch of idiots who would go out in a ring of force, you know, a hard mat sometimes covered with some ropes you wouldn't want to bounce off for anything. And that's what Paul was trying to save me from, I think, knowing that they're out there, knowing that there's some really crappy things involved in the business. And he's right. There were some crappy things involved in the business. And even if they outweighed the good, it was still better than what else was out there in the world, I thought. And I think, you know, because I'll say it, and it still does, it took a special breed to be in the business then. I think it still takes a special breed to be in it now, but it's a different business. So, and once he did that, and once he put his last wrestling matches out there, it made me feel a little better. But, you know, it wasn't until I finally got in the business, really in the business, working for a while, that I think he really finally knew and accepted the fact that this is what I'm going
to
do.
Well, you obviously wanted to be a wrestler, and he was trying to talk you out of it. How did you actually end up in the ring with the Iron Sheik and later Nick Kozak?
Well, I was in the office working, and one Friday, Gary Hart used to come in every Friday morning before the matches to the office and go over the matches with Paul. Well, one Friday, and here's the other thing I did. I always brought workout gear in my car whenever I came down to the office because I wanted to be ready in case that opportunity ever came up. I mean, that was just the way I was thinking. If anything ever comes up, I'm always going to have something to change it. And on this day, Gary brought Muhammad Farouk, was his name in Texas, with him. And I knew nothing about the football player, but Paul had set up this guy. I couldn't tell you the guy's name to save my life, but this guy was a football player. He showed up at the office shortly after that, and Paul asked me if I would take Cosro and the football player to the Coliseum. He says, and you can work out with him if you like. I said, holy shit, that's great. So we went down to the Coliseum. The doors were open. We went in. The ring was already set up. So we go into the dressing room. Nobody's in there, obviously, but we, you know, I start getting dressed. I'm thinking Cosro's going to put his pointy boots on and his trunks. Well, no, he has his wrestling shoes and his singlet, you know, from when he wrestled, you know, AAU or whatever. And we go out to the ring. So we start out by doing squats. We start out by doing push-ups. And I don't remember how many we did. We didn't do more than 100. I do know that because I think he just wanted to stretch this guy and go. But anyway, he said, okay, I'm going to get down on all fours and you try to turn me over. Telling me this. Now I'm about 165 and I'm 15 years old. I have my learner's permit. That's how I could drive. So, and he's in great shape, about 240, solid. And he gets in his hands and knees. And I try to turn him over and he just turtles on me. He just, there's nothing I can do. So then he goes, okay, now I try you. Now you get all fours. Okay, we go. I try to turn you over. So we get on all fours, or I get on all fours, and he hooks me, and somehow, I don't know how he did it either, but he's sitting on my back, and he's bending my neck up. I mean, pulling me up, because I said, okay, because I'll scream, scream. I said, okay, it goes louder, and it makes me scream louder. And finally, he lets go and pushes me away. And he does the same thing to the football player. So we've both been humiliated and disgraced. And then we get up. Now Cosro says, all right, now I teach you how to lock up. And he says, you put your left hand here and your right hand here. Okay, so it's a collar and elbow. My left hand's up behind his back of his neck and goes, and you go hard like this. And he locked up with me and showed me. But then he says, now, we lock up. So I went to lock up, and I slapped him in the ear. Okay? He looks at me and says, I did not say. And he slapped me in the ear hard. He rang the bell pretty good. So I said, okay. Well, we locked up again. This time I did it right. We locked up a couple more times. Then he pushed me away. He said, show the football player, same thing. Locked up again. All right. Now he wants me and the football player to wrestle. Get down all fours. You're going to turn him over. You're going to wrestle. But well, I don't know anything about wrestling. And this guy sure doesn't know anything about wrestling. Football player's a good 240, 6'1, 6'2, whatever. And again, I'm a midget. But we wrestled around until the cousin finally said, okay, enough. And so we were there maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, I guess. And he came back one more time with the football player. The football player quit. And I think Cosmer came back a couple more times. So we trained maybe a month. Those Fridays. And that was it. Then I went to Nick and Joe Mercer. So that's how that came about. It was through Paul at the office, thanks to some football player. But that got me in the door, and that got me to where I didn't quit, didn't bitch about being slapped, didn't bitch about being stretched. I expected it as paying dues. I was all prepared to pay dues. And, you know, it gave me something to relate to. And, you know, I started out later on and then wrestled Cosgrove in Atlanta and a couple other places. I mean, that's how that came about. And that's, once again, you know, it's thanks to Paul. And Paul was giving me an opportunity because I think he knew that old Sheiky baby could be a little salty sometimes and not so friendly.
Gary Hart would come in every Friday. What was a typical week like in the Houston wrestling office?
I got there on Monday. If the grass needed cutting, it just had a little bit of grass on the outside. This was at 1919 Caroline at the corner of Pierce this time because he'd moved from 2022 San Jacinto at the corner of Gray down to 1919 Caroline at the corner of Pierce. Now, you say that because I remember Paul staying these addresses every week. I mean, it was every week the same thing. And at the corner of Gray, you knew if you were at Gray and San Jacinto Street, you look right there, there's the office. And he had these cross streets. So, I mean, it was a great address to remember, and it was a great thing. But Monday, again, we were selling tickets Monday through Friday. Paul would come in usually about an hour after the office opened up, and he'd start on the program. And I knew I'd hear him on the phone talking to people. And we used to send the program out to get printed up. It was a whole different style back then, different way of doing things. They had these big blocks of pictures, and that's the way they printed. I don't know how else to describe it, but they were blocks of pictures. He would pick the different blocks of pictures out and figure out which ones he wanted to use for his program and stories that week. Mostly it was selling tickets, and when Friday came, as I said, Gary would come. Sometimes he'd bring some of the guys, and sometimes they would need rides wherever they needed rides to. First of all, Eric needed a ride over on one part of town where I didn't know where the hell I was going. That was before GPS, as I couldn't read a map for anything back then. But, you know, I dropped him off. That was it. Basically, selling tickets, doing errands, dropping Paul off if he was going to a meeting or a Lions Club or a Rotary Club meeting, whatever it may be. And that was it, man. I mean, it was a dream come true because I'd done it through the summer months when I was in high school. When I graduated high school, I got to work full time there. I mean, that was it. Again, you know, I'd answer the phones, and if someone would call, which they would, for Paul, he wanted to take all calls from fans or whoever it may be. You always switched it back to his office. So, I mean, that was it. Put files away if there was something needed cleaned or, again, just an errand run.
I recently reviewed the book Rowdy on the show, the new biography of Roddy Piper written by Colt and Ariel Toombs. And you're in the book. You supply a picture, I believe, but also you tell some stories about Roddy. And, you know, I feel because there are tapes, so many people can talk about Roddy's career from Los Angeles on, but very few people saw him when he was in Texas, and no one sees any footage of that nowadays. What was it like when he first showed up? What do you remember about young Roddy Piper?
Well, of course, he always had the bagpipes. But, you know, I remember the night that he did get split open, and it was against Blackjack Lanza. I remember the night. I also have the program clip that the program story is in the book, too, that talks about when he played the bagpipes. He was in the Fondy Recreation Center, which is a smaller building than the Sam Houston Coliseum, but the Coliseum wasn't available that night, and I believe the record was skipping, and or the sound was horrible that night, and that's when Paul Bosch stopped the sound man, and asked Roddy to play the national anthem. He wasn't obviously the Roddy Piper that he would become later on, but there was something about him, man. I mean, I don't know how to play the bagpipes, but they just sound like a difficult instrument to master. You know what I mean? I wouldn't know how that works, but he did, and he did it very good. And he was a baby face, and he wasn't there that long either. I don't believe he was there for maybe 4 months, 6 months, if that. Yeah, I don't think he'd see a whole lot of Roddy Piper. I know there's some Houston wrestling footage, but I don't think there's a lot of matches from the 70s. I think they have some, maybe just a few main events from the 70s, but Roddy wasn't in the main event back then. He was a very good wrestler. He was a very good worker, but he was still learning his craft too. So I think he did. I think he did very well. Very well.
There it is, Dr. Tom Pritchard talking about his youth in and around Houston wrestling, and of course, breaking into the wrestling business. And this concludes this special look at Houston. And we want to ask everyone to please keep the people, the citizens of Houston, and of course, all the surrounding towns. So many people are just focusing on Houston, but again, it's an entire region that is feeling this. So please keep everyone in your thoughts. And let's hope that we could do a little bit to help. And let's hope this show does a little bit to get some money in to help out. And once again, the links, one more time, tinyurl.com/Houston Red Cross to donate to the Red Cross, tinyurl.com/GoFundHouston for a page listing all of the GoFundMe accounts and campaigns currently helping the victims of Hurricane Harvey, and of course, tinyurl.com/GlobalGivingHouston, which is a list of organizations locally helping out with Harvey relief now and will be helping out for the foreseeable future. Bix, in closing, as we wrap things up, any final thoughts you have?
I think we covered the hurricane stuff a lot. So I'll just say, as far as Houston wrestling, it was just a very special place because of the mix of wrestlers you would get. And also that it was, I think it embodies Texas wrestling as a style more than anywhere else.
You know, I hadn't thought of that, but that's actually an excellent point. You know, more than Dallas, more than Amarillo, more than El Paso, I guess.
Well, it was part of the Emerald Territory, but sure.
Yeah, but I think you're right. More than San Antonio, I think you're right. Houston really is the epitome of Texas wrestling. And there's a long history, not just Paul Bosch, not just Morris Siegel. Of course, there's been WrestleMania in Houston, and there's been other big shows throughout the years in Houston, Texas, and a lot of wrestlers from in and around Houston, Texas. So everyone's in our thoughts. We hope that any listeners of this show, anyone who follows Bix, anyone who follows myself, if you're listening to this, we're thinking of you. We hope everyone's okay. You know, it's going to be a long road to get everyone back on their feet, to replace everyone's cars, to replace houses, to get everyone fed. And, you know, everyone's in our thoughts. I guess that's the best way to sum it up, Bix.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to sum it up indeed.
Of course, you can follow Bix on Twitter at David Bix. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. But until next time, this has been a special edition of the 605 Super Podcast. Please, let's all keep Houston and the surrounding areas in our thoughts, and let's do what we can to help out. Thank you. We'll talk to you again soon.